This week's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by Housewife, a new movie from RLJ Entertainment. After Holly meets with notorious cult leader Bruce O'Hara, she is led on a twisted journey of waking dreams that begin to unravel the fabric of her reality. Take a trip down the rabbit hole in this visually stunning film from the director of Baskin. Housewife is now available on DVD, VOD, and digital. You can get it on Amazon.com today. Okay, and welcome to episode 118 of Shockwaves. Man, it's like slim pickings every week. This week it's me. I'm here. Rob G is here. Rob Galuzzo.
Just you alone in a room.
I'm talking
at
to
your
my
house.
My conscience is happens to sound like Elric Cain.
You've been doing this show too long, Rob.
I've been doing it so long that the twist, 118 episodes in, the twist is you guys are all in my head.
And it was always killer POV, Rob. It was always
this
killer
is like
POV.
This is like a split like sequel. Yeah. I am doing all the voices.
There was no Elric.
There is
there
no,
never
there's
was
no
an
Ernie
Elric.
Recording.
There was
right
no
now.
Becca, and there was definitely no Ryan. None of it's all. It's always been you, Rebecca. Rob.
Wow. Oh, Rebecca? Oh, my
Rob.
God. Oh, God. Hi, Elric Cain.
Hey, man.
Are you really here? Yeah, you are.
I was here. I don't know if I was fully there at the – we did a little Tom Atkins thing this weekend, and unfortunately I was feeling a little – I got some
out of
stomach
yeah.
thing. Mentally I was fine, except for thinking that he was in Exorcist 3. I realized why that was, though, because the main cop in Exorcist 3 is in – Ninth configuration, which is what we're talking about. Yeah. So my brain
and those are great
them.
Stories about that. That's going to be our.
I wasn't expecting him to go into spend most of our interview talking about that obscure film, but I love that film. So
yeah,
that was fun.
That was a great chat. A lot of great stories, and that will be our Halloween episode.
Yeah, so people will get to hear that one.
You will get to hear it. We just dropped the bonus episode, which you haven't listened to yet, or you did.
I haven't heard
Castle.
That one yet.
Well,
yeah.
That's a great fun one. But let's get some plugs out of the way. When people hear this, you will be in Knoxville, correct?
I'll be at the Knoxville Horror Film Festival. I am there from all of Friday, all of Saturday, all of Sunday. The awards are Sunday. Friday, I'll just be watching. I'm judging the film features and the shorts.
Yeah.
And then on Saturday, I believe, I am introducing a little film called Zombie in 4K by
Ooh.
Fulci. So I'm excited to get to intro that. And then Sunday, we will be recording a quote-unquote Shockwaves.
Oh,
even though I'm the
you.
Only one. But we've got a guy called JK. We've got Jill Gervaisian.
Nice.
Sorry if I butchered your name. And Brian Lonano, the director of William that we met
oh,
last
wow.
time. So they're all the judges. So it's going to be, and I'm going to actually, it's kind of fun. I'm going to do the, whether this will ever be heard by our listeners will depend on the recording quality.
The quality, yeah.
You never know.
We don't have Ernie going to
yeah,
Knoxville.
On location. You never know how this goes. But we're going to do a little thing that we did in the first episode of Pure Cinema, which was Handshake 5. I'm going to get them to do their Handshake 5 for horror.
Oh, that's great.
It's the films that kind of made them who they are. So that should be fun. And that's something we should do at some point on our show.
Oh, but, yeah. We haven't done that before.
Not really. But yeah.
And you'll get to see, I think it's right before Shockwaves, one of Epic's films, The Man Who Killed Hitler and then
that's
The
right.
Bigfoot.
That's part
it's
of the competition, I think. I'm not sure yeah. if it's in competition, but that one I have to watch. There's some good ones. Some I haven't seen Anna and the Apocalypse yet. That'll be there.
Oh, man. I love that movie.
But I haven't even seen the new Halloween movie, so what the hell do I know?
Well, we'll get to that in a minute. Let's get through all our plugs. Let me be self-serving for a minute and shameless, because nobody from Blumhouse is actually in the hallways right now paying attention to us, so I can talk about my label. Dread Presents. Right now, and I know this is a big deal to me, To Hell and Back, The Kane Hodder Story, which is one of my favorite films we put out, it's on Amazon Prime. So
nice.
No more excuses. If you got Amazon, please watch this documentary. It's really solid. Elric Cain was a big fan of the Kane.
Yeah, I'm a fan.
So please check that out. I think it's really solid and one of the best things we've done. What else did you have?
Our good buddy Graham Skipper, who you all know as both a filmmaker and actor and many, many things. He has been doing some sort of I don't know. I mean, I wish I knew more about it, but I know it's this crazy mixture between like rock opera and circus called shapeshiftercircus.com. And they have events the day this airs, Friday and Saturday, October 19th and 20th, the 26th, 27th, and November 2nd and 3rd. It's in Glendale. Look it up because it looks wild. Like, it's somewhere, I mean, I have to assume it's in a bar-type venue, but the whole thing looks like a party. It's also kind of designed a little bit with Suspiria postery.
Oh, yeah, and this is his wife, actually, who, Jordana,
mixture,
who,
yeah.
Yeah, who I believe he created the show with, or she created it. It's her thing.
But I'd heard him talk about it months ago and then just forgotten that's what he was working on. And just, it just sounds wild. So if you're interested in saying wild, I think we're meant to be going in the early November. So it's kind
of Shockwave. Well, it's I'm looking at the dates now. This is for all you L.A. folks. It's October 19th, 20th, 26th, 27th, and then November 2nd, 3rd. And I believe we're all going on November 2nd.
Yeah. So the only bad thing about that is we can't go early to then plug it to all of you and tell you how cool it is. So you just have to take a risk.
And meet us there. Meet us there on November 2nd.
But,
that's the way to go.
But it sounds fun, so I wanted to make sure we gave it a plug. Anyone who goes outside the box to make some sort of mad artistry deserves our love.
Yes, 100%. And then let's pimp trailers. I think it's fun today. Well, today when you hear this, it'll be 2 days old. But Entertainment Weekly debuted the trailer to our co-host Becca's movie,
right,
All the Creatures Stirring.
Which
it's
is
your
coming
first
out
look.
Soon, though, isn't it?
It'll be on VOD December 4th.
Oh, okay.
And then I think there's a Blu-ray coming out maybe January 7th or something like that.
Okay.
But yeah, it'll be available digitally everywhere on December 4th from RLJ.
Did you watch the trailer?
I did.
It's a good trailer.
It's pretty cool. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I've seen the movie now, so I could watch the trailer.
You could watch the trailer.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a little, you know, it's, I've noticed this in general, and it'd be fun to go back on YouTube and check. It's much harder to sell an anthology because you're literally getting random footage from multiple stories completely out of context.
It's like you're selling the tone.
Yeah, and so that's basically what this trailer does. Is it sells the tone and the kind of the wackiness and shows a lot of the familiar faces, obviously.
Yeah.
No, we're proud of her, and she's shooting another movie right now. So.
And speaking of which, I believe her film is playing at Knoxville.
Oh, is it really?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Oh.
But it might be playing the Thursday night, not the Friday, so by the time you hear this, it might have already played to people, but either way, it is playing.
Yeah, and also another trailer today, not exactly horror, but in that wheelhouse and something that I think we all should mention, but Karen Kasuma.
Oh, man, I cannot wait
Her
for this
last
movie.
Film was The Invitation, which ended up being, I think, all of our one of our favorites of that year,
for sure. And it out of most movies, you know how you do a number one. Some movies, if you asked a year later, we should do a show where we have to look at our top 10 from last year a year later and see which ones have actually stayed with you.
Because my opinion definitely changes.
Because that's a film that definitely gets better with time. I haven't even seen it again, but just thinking about it, you're like, that's an adult film. That's a complex
100%. So this is her new movie called Destroyer.
Nicole.
And it stars Nicole Kidman, and it's out on Christmas Day, 12/25.
It's a bummer that I have to wait that long. It has played some fests, and it just sounds badass. Like, that's the kind of movie I want. And plus, I have been saying this for the last few years. Nicole Kidman, like Nick Cage is like, you know, my favorite thing in movies. But Nicole Kidman, if you look at the work she's been doing since Eyes Wide Shut, she is amazing. Whether it's Stoker or whatever, you know, she's just always taking risks and laying it all out there.
Yeah.
She's a great actress.
All right, so there's that. We have tons of movies to talk about, but before we delve into movies, I do want to talk about a book I've been reading. I'm not done with it yet. It's one of those books where I'm really taking my time because I'm enjoying it so much that I want to savor it. And this is the biography of Don Coscarelli, the great Don Coscarelli, True Indie, Life and Death in Filmmaking. I've got it right here. It's got a bunch of endorsements on the back from Bruce Campbell, Rob Zombie, J.J. Abrams, David Wong. And, you know, if you've heard him on any interview, he was on our show. He gave a great chat with him there. And I just heard him on what's the Trailers from Hell podcast again? The Movies That
Made Me.
He was on that, and that was a great show because it was the first time he had to talk not about horror.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was fun to hear him talk about the art. Yeah, because so the only reason I haven't started this, I bought a copy too when he did our Miskatonic, but because he did 2.5 hour in depth, he had to obviously go, and probably he was a little reticent because he doesn't want to give all the best stuff away.
Yeah, all the best stuff, yeah.
But he really went deep, so I felt like I need a little break before I dive into the book.
Well, what's cool about this book and what's been making it so fun and easy to read is there's literally like, good God, there's like 100 chapters here. There's so many chapters.
So short little bursts.
But that's what it is every chapter is literally a 2 or 3 page story and anecdote.
Oh, cool.
So it goes chronologically in his life, but he's like a great, I don't want to say joke teller because they're not jokes, but he's great at setting up an experience or a story and then paying it off in under 2-3. He's a great, just a great storyteller. And that's why I've been having so much fun with this book. And I'm just getting through him finishing his first film, at Universal.
That's great, how young
at
he
20
was.
Years yeah, old. 20 years old. And it's been, he's already met Angus Scrimm and Reggie Bannister. So it's just great fun. And
he's literally touring everywhere. So if you're listening to this, this isn't one of those things where you could only see him in LA. His book tour, I think, is taking him to every town in America. So
pretty
I would
much.
Look it up. You know?
Yeah, yeah. And he's usually doing screenings of one of his movies yep. while he's there. And we'll have him back at some point. He wanted to come on for the book, but he did Mixed Show, and rightfully so. I feel like we
yeah.
should keep that separate.
yeah.
You know, so we'll talk to him again probably in the new year. So True Indie, Life and Death in Filmmaking by Don Coscarelli. Strongly recommend it. And let's see, today—
We'll get him on when Beastmaster gets that Criterion. I'm all about a Beastmaster Criterion, really.
As it should. As it should. Man, do we got a lot of movies to talk about. But today is October 19th when you hear this. Uh-huh. And tonight is the release of Halloween.
They're re-releasing Carpenter's thing?
Yeah, No. There's a— Elric, just in case you didn't know, there's a new movie. Uh-huh. One of our co-hosts produced it.
Wait, so it's, not H2O. So
no,
after
it's H2O, H40. It's H40. 40,
that's
yes.
the name? H40?
No, it's not the name. That's what I'm calling it because okay. it's 40 years okay. later. It's actually called Halloween, which is confusing because there's Halloween.
I saw trailers going around, but I didn't watch anything. I assumed it was
Have you really not seen trailers for it?
I actually, with this, I've seen like three quarters of Actually, it was early with you when Ryan showed us an early teaser.
Yes.
Back when we weren't allowed to talk about it. I did see that. So I kind of got enough of like the tone, but then I was like, you know what? Now I'm just going.
Now you're ready.
Total radio silence. I know nothing.
Well, great. Look, it's kind of, most people have probably seen it last night as a midnight screening or whatever, but it comes out today. I will give a non-spoiler review, and it's a lot easier without Ryan here, even though, don't worry, Ryan, I'm not. I love the movie. It's fine. I love the movie. I thought it was really great. Let me preface a few things. It was really it's not perfect by any means. Yeah. But the way I saw it is, honestly, and if you haven't seen it yet, this is exactly how I recommend you see it. I saw it at Beyond Fest as a double feature with the original. So seeing it back to back, and I know the original by heart. Yeah. Like I've seen the original Halloween a million times. Yeah. Still, it helped tremendously watching it right before because there's so many subtle callbacks and references and things that I don't know if I would have remembered exactly had I not seen it literally right before.
Yeah.
And so if you can, try to watch the original movie right before you go to see the new one because it'll be a much more satisfying experience. That said, the weird thing about the new movie is that I'd say the first half is okay. It's interesting. But the reason it's just okay to me as a diehard Halloween fan is because no matter what, I have 10 Halloween movies in my head that I'm already thinking of. And so I know they're starting as a direct sequel to the original – but some of the setup and some of what they do to set this story up is familiar. So it's like, oh, this is kind of like Halloween 4, but oh, wait, this is kind of like H2O. It's just
and a little bit of Eastbound and Down?
Yes, exactly. it's just by default, you can't avoid it. It's like, if you're
your
setting
expectations
up,
are there.
If you're setting, but you're, if you're setting up any story that's, okay, Michael Myers, Laurie Strode, it's going to have little remnants of things you already have seen.
Yeah.
That said, though, where the strength of the film lies, other than Jamie Lane because she's terrific, is I'd say the last 30 minutes or so, whatever, the last act is the most satisfying of any Halloween movie ever. It's pure setup and just fucking brilliant execution so that
awesome.
Literally it's all the last act is all payoff.
Yeah, cool.
And and again, if you watch it back to back with the original, it's just so satisfying. And we had a great crowd for it, and the few
screenings you also had Black Christmas wedged in there
yes,
at the start, which,
the very,
which
very
is
beginning.
Also, you know, a brilliant movie.
Very, very much in the vein of it, but it's a great audience movie, and it's probably for me my favorite since the original. And I love Halloween too.
Yeah, and 3 doesn't count as part of that thing. So
yeah, so it's pretty up there.
I think 2 is really fun.
I love 2.
Kundi's work on that's brilliant.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it has some stuff that doesn't work. I mean, yeah, the problem with 2 is having her having her in a, you know, a hospital bed for so much of the story doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah,
but you know.
Yeah, and it was actually really funny. We were at the Halloween convention where we did this past weekend. where I had a very Larry David moment where I showed up and nothing went right for me, at least. You guys all had a good time, but you weren't feeling well.
I wasn't there long,
It took them a half hour to figure out who I was and to check me in. And then I went to go. The first panel was Halloween 2, the original. And I got locked in between the doors where you're supposed to do the panel room for like 5 minutes. And then I finally got there. It was running late. They finally brought the talent. Totally. 13 people on stage, not including me, that I had to maneuver. Like, I was like, oh my God, how am I going to do this? We worked it out. It was a great time. Somebody proposed to their girlfriend in the middle of the Q&A while Dick Warlock was answering a question, which was kind of fun. But it was funny. Somebody in the audience was just like, how do you feel about the new movie ignoring yours completely? And it was like dead silence.
Right? That's funny, yeah.
And then Lance Guest, was in it, he played Jimmy, is that the character's name? I don't remember. But Lance Guest was just
and
like...
And the last Starfighter connection with Nick Castle.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Lance Guest is like, well, we all died, so what do we care?
Yeah.
He's like, now we live. That's totally fine. So that was a lot of fun.
Something else very significant happened at that day. For those who don't see my Instagram or Twitter, as exciting as it always is to meet a Tom Atkins, there was only one human being who I've wanted to meet since the very beginning. And thanks to Sean Clark, otherwise it wouldn't have happened, because I thought he might have been coming on our show. So that's a dream for another day. But Sean Clark took me to the front of this line of people who are all waiting for his autograph, and I never like doing things like that, but he's like, this is your only chance to tell Tommy Lee Wallace how much you love Fright Night Part 2.
Yes.
And I literally walked up to my guy, you know, I think it's one of the greatest sequels ever, and the pure joy on this guy. Rebecca took a bunch of photos. She was standing there, but I saw his face, like he was like, hey! And then he was like, and so I got to sit for a second and talk to him, but then I said to Sean, whatever it takes, we need to get him down to the show.
So he's a great guy.
He seems so nice.
Yeah. No, I love Tommy Lee. I did a Fright Night panel with him and the whole Fright Night crew years ago. And the Halloween 3 commentary, and it's just, it'd be fun. He doesn't live here, and just so you guys know, we kind of need the people to come to the studio. It's just much a different show. We can't Skype in or anything like that.
He's not as far. I used to think he was a lot further away than he actually is. So I did find out. So it's much more doable than I thought it was. So that's a dream. But it was funny because we've met so many famous people, but that one felt kind of special because it's such a small,
it's like you getting excited by the guy from Things showing up at your cafe. That's a big deal for Elmer Cain. Tommy Lee, you know. But look, love the new Halloween. I think everyone else is going to have a great time with it. And by the way, score, awesome.
Because I don't mind spoilers in that way, like without spoiling. How does he approach doing a new score?
Let me be honest with you. I mean, what's cool is obviously he's doing it with his kids, which is Cody Carpenter and Daniel Davies. And so what they've started on the Lost themes, I love both Lost Themes
albums. Me too. I think they're great.
I kind of like 2 a little better because 2 to me sounds like a band. The first one was done kind of like whatever, remotely they'd send each other clips. But part 2 sounds like all three of them were in a room writing this music together. And so this score continues from that. There's not a ton of music, believe it or not. I already got the soundtrack and it's like 45 minutes of music. A lot of it is reworked themes, so a lot of it is the themes you already know, kind of done slightly differently or done with newer equipment. There's one or two new themes that are so badass.
Yeah.
But what's funny is I wish they went further with it because I feel like they were like, let's stay with basically the approach to the movie.
Yeah.
Let's keep it simple. Let's stay with what the original is, but let's just, poke at some of this cool new stuff. But they don't go full out with it, which is kind of like what I wish they would do.
Do you still get their stingers or not?
Yeah, there's a few in the movie itself. Yes, not so much on the on the soundtrack, but there's a track called "The Shape Hunts Allison," and it's like my favorite piece of music. I'll play it for you right now.
Oh, that's different. Yeah, that's almost Italian.
Yeah, somebody said it best. They were like, see, like there's cool stuff going on.
Oh, that sound was a spoiler. Something happened right then. I know he just jumped out. Now I can't watch the movie.
No, it's not. It's just
hunting Allison.
No, it's a bow across the guitar, Elric. That's how that sound was achieved. Somebody said it sounds like all the people that ripped Carpenter off.
Oh, funny.
That's now what his scores sound like, is like somebody that would rip him off.
Yeah.
But anyway, Halloween, there you have it, man. And I can't wait to hear what you think of it.
Wow, that's some crazy stuff. Yeah, and I'm looking forward to seeing that. I just want to thank, there's a great podcast called Supporting Characters by Bill Ackerman. I tweeted before I went to New York that I was going there, and there was a new film by Claire Denis who made that horror film Trouble Every Day.
Oh, yeah.
And her new film's with Robert Pattinson in space, where all these criminals have it called High Life. They've all been sent. It's an art house film that sci-fi horror in the case that like a lot of extremity happens in it. But Robert Pattinson in space, because they've put anyone who's on death row into space for exploration purposes because it's going to take so long, so that they give them that's their way out. And super interesting movie, definitely not for all crowds, but there's a crazy sex box thing. It's kind of like 2001 if it had more sex and like weird kind of derangement. But so I tweeted that I want a ticket to the sold out thing. Bill, who is an awesome guy, I just, as soon as my plane lands, like, just so you know, there's a ticket, you've got like an hour and a half to get to the major theater. I get to the theater, and this is why this is a great story. The guy whose ticket it is, right? So the guy I'm going to be sitting next to, so Bill facilitated this, turns out to be one Daniel Bird. Daniel Bird is the world's leading expert on the film Possession by Zulawski.
Get out of here.
He's produced every single one of the documentaries and things on. He worked with Zulawski closely in Poland. He lives in Poland. He just was visiting. And the festival gave him two tickets to this one event. And so I get to sit with him. I get to spend my whole night getting actual stories about Zulawski, true stories about what was going on behind the scenes.
Is there
going to
be a podcast about what you learned, or did you sworn to secrecy?
Probably. Hanging out with the two of them, I said afterwards, if there had been a microphone, some of the stuff we were just talking about would have been the best fucking episode, but we were all just at a bar afterwards. But it was so cool for me because he's a guy, I'd read his things early when I was like, had early discovered the film like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I had read Eyeball Compendium, was a really cool horror anthology magazine. And so it was just cool to meet this guy and be like, thanks for all the cool shit you've written and all the work you did, but it just totally far out. So thanks to those guys. The movie itself, High Life, was super interesting. I also got to see Trouble Every Day on 35. So there's two Denis movies. Trouble Every Day, again, strange art house horror film with Vincent Gallo. But we've talked about that one before. So I just wanted to mention the event itself.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about, I don't know if you've had a chance to see it yet, but Eli Roth's History of Horror. Did you get to watch episode one?
I have not. I do not have AMC anymore.
Okay.
However, what was cool was they were showing snippets of it at Beyond Fest as it pertained to the movies.
Mm-hmm.
So we got like a 5-minute clip in between the Halloween movies as it pertained to Halloween.
Okay.
And what I saw of it was pretty excellent. So,
I think it's probably going to go down as best thing Ross made, except for the first half of You Know What, Knock Knock. I'll always stick by that first half of Knock Knock. I have one major problem with this movie. And look, there's no way in an hour you can do each of these topics full justice, right? But I just could. The problem is, look, it's on AMC, right? So they bookend it front and back with Walking Dead when you're just talking about zombies. And of course, Walking Dead is a major phenomenon, so you definitely need it in there. They give beautiful amount of time to George, so I was very happy with that. But I have a motherfucking problem when the word Fulci is not mentioned aloud.
At all?
Not aloud. There's clips of playing in the background of zombie here and there. Not one point does somebody say the word Fulci. And I'm like, guys, that's insane. Especially given Eli, I know, is big Italian.
Are there more episodes, though?
There are, but not on that theme.
I was going to say, could there be a Fulci or an Italian horror?
Then I would forgive. I think they're more basic than that, though. I think it's like Slasher. I think Slashers has a two-parter. I think it's Vampires. I think, look, don't get me wrong. Like, but I mean, come on. Cemetery Gates, to me, is a pretty high point in zombie horror filmmaking. And just even to say, you could have just talked about the global influence of it. But again, I'm picking hairs. I thought that was excellent. I think the people they chose to talk to, Ryan's even in there, but the people in general were really fascinating. But the production value is high. And the fact that you've got Stephen King, someone who is almost impossible to get to do things like this, and his insights were great. So I loved it, but as a card-carrying Fulci Lives member for the rest of my life, I have to say something. Otherwise, he will be forgotten. He isn't Romero, don't get me wrong, but he is
He was
important.
Thanked by Bob Murawski when he won the Oscar for The Hurt Locker. So
exactly.
There's that.
Exactly. All of us who have a cat in the brain, we need to mention it when we can. but it is really good, and I think you'd be insane to miss it. Then only thing, another quibble I'd have with it was like, what the hell is it doing coming on at midnight on the West Coast? You're like, guys, don't you want this to rate? Like, you know.
Well, I just went on the AMC website and it's on here. I'm hoping that means I can watch it with no problems.
Hopefully, yeah.
So I'm going to try to watch this a little bit later.
I got to say, I'm
tonight.
Pretty. I mean, zombies, I see why they started with it because Walking Dead had just come back.
Yeah.
But I'm real excited for like the 2-part slasher one.
Yeah.
Especially the fact that they're giving it some a little bit of time there. But yeah, no, otherwise, they spend enough time on Romero that I can. And it was basically, most of it was probably Romero and Shaun of the Dead, actually. It was just, and which made sense as counterpoints and then Walking Dead. So,
yeah.
But it's cool, and I'm glad he got to make this with some real funds behind it. So,
speaking of, are you watching that terrible show that everyone's tuned out of?
I am still in, and I am
still
up to
in.
Date. You know, okay, so it's interesting. The ratings are at their lowest as it's coming back on, even though people know Rick's going to die or, well, be no longer in the show.
We don't
know what that's going to look like. I thought the first episode was pretty solid, and I was like, oh, this is interesting. But they still fall into the – I think, for me, the show isn't that it kept going, and it isn't that they had a plot. It's that they just keep adding too many humans, and you always – it's kind of gone into the Star Trek mode where it's like, oh, red shirt, people we don't – you know, so who cares, right? But I'm at this point, now that I know there's an end in sight for that character, it's like, of course I'm going to watch the end. Now, that said, will I watch a single episode after he's no longer in it? I doubt it. Mm. Is my gut, because he, to me, was the show.
Right.
For me.
No, like, one of the other characters, or one of the other actors, is her contract is up.
Which is hard to believe, because they're kind of like the one from The Boy.
Yeah.
Cullen or whatever, Laura Cullen.
Yeah.
And she's the other kind of main figure in this. So I don't, you know, so what's his name still in the world?
Daryl's. Yeah.
No, the guy with the bat. You know, he's still around.
Oh yeah, Negan. But
so it's like, who knows what they'll
Norman
do
Reedus
that.
Will be bumped up to lead. I guess.
I'm curious what they'll do. You know, but I get it. Like, I've got to say, like, I think they had their chance. Man, they had that window where they had that really brutal episode. You know, to launch with Negan and everything. It's like, if it had just gone all the way. But of course, you know.
I thought that one went too far. That's
no,
what
I did. But
lost
I think
me.
If they'd stayed there, maybe they could have like gone all full horror. But they went totally after that one. They, because of the outrage, they pulled so far back. I think, and it all became, in my opinion. But so, yep, still there. I'll be the one on our team to finish.
Fine.
You know, just to report back.
Great.
and the other thing, I was going to watch a lot of movies this week.
I know, but I know where you're going at, and I haven't been there yet. So tell me.
Man,
Netflix?
Look, it's rare that somebody knocks something out of the park like this is knocked out of the park, but Mike Flanagan's Haunting of Hill House is a total home run for me. I could see it being less effective for some people. I think a lot of people are going to love it. It is so close. People online who keep comparing it to 6 Feet Under are dead on. There's some obvious parallels in terms of one of the characters' jobs, but it is so close to the structure of that show. The emotional payoff of that show, and that was one of my favorite shows of all time. The way it treats, it's still got creepy vibes, but isn't always trying to, always interested in pushing the horror side. Sometimes it's really more focused on the trauma and grief. There's nothing really you could put out there to really spoil this show. It's because it's not about as much about the story as it is about all these characters. But by the time this thing ended, I cared so much. I don't remember the last time I cared about horror characters that much, where I was really invested in all their characters, all their life. I think it's like heads and shoulders his best piece of work. Like,
wow.
Not even close. Especially, I mean, there's an episode 6 where everything's like more or less one take. At least the first half of it, and you're just like, Jesus, this is him like getting this huge canvas. All these great, every actor gets a chance to shine like an episode of their story. And I really liked where it landed, and it reminded me of 6 Feet Under in that way. So I can't say enough about it, but I will say, add this to those who don't think it's spooky. It's the first, I think it was after like episode 7, and because I was watching them in such close succession, because I wanted to finish before this, because once I got, like, I didn't expect to do that. I thought I'd watch one, and I watched 2, and I was like, yeah, this is really interesting. I got hooked. I actually had a night of real nightmares.
For
the first time, I can't remember the last horror film that gave me nightmares, and there were nightmares really related to the show. Like, I was thinking of, there was a lot of wind in the house, and it was creaking a lot that night, and I was having these fitful nightmare dreams very similar to the ghosts and the stuff in that story. So because it's so kind of slow burn, and it's all just like things in the background, and it's not in the foreground, the horror, I think that got under my skin eventually more than – because there's almost no almost no jump scares. There's a couple, but it's not that kind of horror. It's, and so I really appreciated that for a change. But yeah, it did. It really kind of got me one night. So that was kind of interesting.
You and Stephen King, did you see his tweet about it?
He liked it a lot, right?
He said, yeah, I have it pulled up right here. The Haunting of Hill House, revised and remodeled by Mike Flanagan. I don't usually care for this kind of revisionism, but this is great. Close to a work of genius, really. I think Shirley Jackson would approve, but who knows for sure.
It's also as close as I'd get to calling something, you know, Kubrickian in terms of style, which not totally formal style, but more than most contemporary filmmakers, which makes it really interesting to me that he is directing
Dr. Sleep,
which I know very little about.
Same here.
And so,
but you know, what's interesting about that, and we're only speculating, so don't jump down my throat. Yeah. I haven't read the book.
Yeah.
I feel he's the type of filmmaker that is going to somehow figure out how to simultaneously honor the book and the movie that we know and love. And one of the reasons is because you know that Alex Esso from Starry Eyes was cast as Wendy.
Yeah, and Jocelyn Donahue got cast.
Jocelyn Donahue's in
it, too. That's all of my favorite
people.
Incredible. That's
but the point being is the version of Wendy that, that Alex looks like is my sweet Shelley Duvall.
Yeah.
Not the blonde girl in the
book. Totally Shelley Duvall.
So that means that has to adhere to
the movie.
I also think
if a filmmaker like Flanagan is going to do exactly what Kubrick did, which is I have to make my movie out of this. And this would give you utter confidence if you're King watching this series, because this is like 10 hours of somebody going, it's like perfectly done. Whether you like it or not, like some people won't like the series, but either way, you couldn't really argue. It's like a perfectly, you know, created and structured piece. So yeah, I'm excited to see what he does with Dr. Sleep. But I'm almost even more impressed with some of the actors and the kid actors and the way the story, you know, kind of goes back and forth. It's super impressive. So
cool.
That took all my it meant I watched no movies. I wanted to watch Terrified. I wanted to watch, but I had the same problem with you with Shudder and Terrified.
I can't get it on Amazon.
I was bummed. I wanted to see it day one.
There's some sort of weird disconnect between the Amazon account. But I'm gonna, and I think that's part of my. It wasn't a reluctance. It's just that I know once I start, you know, the Haunting on Hill House, I'll marathon it.
Yeah.
And there's just too much. I'm actually in the middle. I'll go here. I'm in the middle of a Hammer Horror binge and marathon. I don't want to spend too much time on all these movies, but I will tell you that there is. I started with this, and I've ordered other box sets too, but right now there's a Hammer Horror 8-film collection on Blu-ray. I also had this on DVD for a while, and I am six out of the 8 movies I've marathoned through. First is Brides of Dracula with Peter Cushing.
Is that the one with the red-headed Dracula guy?
Yes.
I think that's one of the most beautiful of all the movies.
It's probably one of the best.
Yeah. Like, I remember seeing that on TV going, oh my God, this is a great movie.
And what I love about it, by the way, is so it's not really Dracula. It's basically this woman who is coming into town and she ends up meeting at a bar, like this older woman. And she's like, oh, you can come back and stay at my place. And when she goes, she sees her very attractive son in a different part of the house and he's chained down. Mm. And she stupidly lets him off the chains. And so, you know, he's a vampire. And he starts, you know, sucking the blood of women and making them kind of his brides or whatever. And so, but what I love about it is like at the halfway point, you're following the story. In comes Peter Cushing just to get a drink at the bar. And he's like, oh, my name is Van Helsing. What's going on here?
Yeah.
You're just like, oh. And I mean, he's one of those actors. I love Vincent Price anytime he pops in a movie, but Peter Cushing is the man.
He is totally. I've always thought that. I agree.
The photo I posted the other day was from Brides of Dracula. Because without any hesitation, the second that guy comes into the room, he just like reaches in and pulls out his crucifix and he's ready to fight.
Yeah.
And it's like, such man, he's so good. So I watched The Brides of Dracula, which is great. The second film on here is The Curse of the Werewolf. Which is Oliver Reed.
Yep.
And in fact, I think it's
too.
Oliver Reed's first movie. And this one's excellent. I've always loved this one, but it's I misremembered it. Basically, this whole backstory, like the whole first half hour, is about like this homeless beggar that gets like ridiculed by like this king or whatever, and after they ridicule him, they just throw him into the jail in the basement of this castle, and this mute woman is the one that feeds him and helps him, and then something happens where she gets trapped in there, and so he rapes this mute woman, and then their child becomes Oliver Reed. And so he's like a werewolf through this weird
act of
violence. It's really bizarre, but you know, he then gets adopted by a much more well-off family, and when he grows up, he starts to have these tendencies again. But he's a very cool-looking werewolf. And so, yeah, no, it's a super cool movie. In fact, part of the design they got for for Monster Squad is when it, like, basically the way he's dressed is from this movie. And then I'll just go really quick. Night Creatures is another one with Peter Cushing, also released as Captain Clegg. And that's more of like this notorious pirate that ended up dying, well, supposedly dying in this little town. And, you know, like this law enforcement is looking for him. And Peter Cushing is the priest who's trying to get rid of these people out of the town because they don't want to dredge up the memories and all that. But there's some fun twists. Then there's The Phantom of the Opera. I talked about this on Shockwaves or maybe even Killer POV a couple years ago. I love this version of Phantom. And I feel like this is where a lot of maybe Phantom of the Paradise came from, in the sense that this version of the Phantom, like, yes, of course, initially he's scary, he's wearing a mask, he's killing people, etc. But really it's a story about an artist that was completely ripped off by a very young Michael Goff, Alfred of the Tim Burton Batman movies. He's ripped off, left for dead, and is basically getting his just revenge. And so I've always loved this version. He wears this cool, like, blank mask with just one eye hole.
I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, so that one's great. Cool. And then Paranoiac, which is kind of one of the Psycho ripoffs of that era, with Oliver Reed. It's in black and white. It's Oliver Reed. It's this guy that looks just like Tony Perkins, who is supposedly the long lost brother of this family who was believed to have committed suicide. And so they're trying to figure out, is it really him? What happened? Blah, blah, blah. And then the last I left off it was The Kiss of the Vampire, which was another movie where a young newlywed couple go to town, and then a cult of vampires, not just a vampire, a cult of vampires set their sights on the wife. And they're like, oh, we want her to be part of our vampire cult.
Sounds a little bit like Mandy.
Yeah, pretty much. Right? There's a little Mandy there. Maybe Panos is a big fan of The Kiss of the Vampire. But here's the thing. I have always had a blind spot for Hammer Horror, and for whatever reason, this is the year that it is all clicked, and so I'm all in. I'm going to finish this box set. I got another one on the way with four more movies.
Oh, cool.
And I have a UK one I bought a couple years ago that's got 21 discs in it.
What else is on this one that you didn't watch
yet? I didn't watch the last two, which is Nightmare and The Curse of the Frankenstein?
The Evil Frankenstein.
The Evil Frankenstein, yeah. Which I think I have seen that in the past.
I've seen that one.
So, yeah, I'm pretty much looking forward to those. Otherwise, other movies, let's see. So I finally watched Jigsaw.
Oh, that's right. I saw your post with that. Yeah,
Have you seen it?
Yeah. I saw it right on when it first hit disc.
Now, here's the thing.
I mean, I didn't think it was terrible. I found it watchable. I just didn't care anymore.
I kind of loved it.
Yeah. No, I
and the reason being, so Jigsaw came out in 2017. Uh-huh. This is the eighth Saw movie at this point. Yeah. But the thing is, I haven't watched a Saw movie since the seventh one came out in theaters. So it's been X amount of years. And I just went in blindly. I didn't marathon the other movies. Again, I always think it's better to watch these out of context. Yeah. So it was just whatever my basic memory was. And it just worked. It rekindled all the things I love about Saw, which is like, okay, what's going on here? Who's connected to who? How does Jigsaw fit in, etc.? Because the great gimmick of this one is that Jigsaw's been dead for 10 years. So it's like, how it's obviously him, but how can it be him? And so I really like that twist. And basically,
by the Spearing Brothers, right?
Yes.
So I do like their stuff. But
stylistically, it's cool.
I was a little disappointed they didn't go further away from the others. Like, it felt like it was still too much in that world of that kind of everyone's pretty and the color palettes that weird. You know, I kind of wish they really took it.
Yeah, and I still think there's room for a Saw movie like that. It just goes radically left turn. Yeah. But basically, I look at it as you can watch 1 through 3 and just this one. Like, this one almost completely discredits 4 through 7.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a good thing because they got, like, I like those movies, but they got super complicated, and it's like, if you just like the Jigsaw story, because he's the lead of the first three, this is a good little cherry on the cake, or, you know, cherry on top of your ice cream movie to satisfy fans of the first three. So whatever, it's not great, it's not bad. I just was pleasantly surprised because my bar was so low, And I just haven't seen a Saw movie in a long time that it ticked all the boxes of what I love about those movies.
If you're on a plane, it's a good watch.
Well, I don't know about that.
You're trapped on a plane.
You're trapped on a plane, yeah.
Wait, they never did Jigsaw on a plane, just like Exorcist on a plane. Well, these plane movies we could be making.
We can Jigsaw in space. I mean, that should have happened at some point, yeah. So I definitely loved that. Do you have any other movies or things you wanted to talk about?
Nah, I mean, like Haunting, I mean, that was 10 hours of my life dedicated to that. I'm about to, in Knoxville, I think I'm looking at like, I don't know, 10 or 12 new movies. So I'm going to be like bulking up.
You'll have plenty. Okay, well, I'll mention a few more quick things then. The Convent, Mike Mendez's movie.
I've still never seen it. I want to see it.
Bloody Disgusting has a series of revival screenings that's been going on all month. And it's usually double feature of like a classic slasher. So this one was paired up with Sweet 16 and The Convent. But you know, Mike Mendez is a good friend of ours. He did a Big Ass Spider, one of the directors on Tales of Halloween. It was just a lot of fun to see this on the big screen. It is very much of its time, which I believe was 2000, yes. But basically, after this, it's like it's a bunch of possessed nuns, basically. Kids break into...
Where's Becca?
Yeah, I know. If she hasn't seen this, which I think she has,
I'm sure she
would love it.
Yeah.
It's just a group of kids that break into a shut-down church. There's fun cameos of Bill Moseley and Coolio as the cops that kick them out, which is... Yeah, exactly.
Bill Moseley and Coolio together at last.
And by the way, Coolio is second billed in this movie because back in 2000, Coolio could sell a movie.
Oh, yeah.
That's what was happening back then. Joe Bishara did the music. It's the first time he met Mike Mendez, and it's very electronic / 2000. Let's put it that way. But it is a fun relic of that time period, and Adrienne Barbeau kicks ass in it. She's the main girl that basically in the opening scene, there's a kick-ass girl in a leather jacket that guns down all these possessed nuns, and then years later they have to go back to her because we've resurrected the nuns again, and the older version of her is Adrienne Barbeau in a kick-ass leather jacket on a motorcycle with guns ready to kick nun ass. So
that's how they got her for Tales of Halloween, I guess.
Yeah, I believe that they've... Connection. Yeah, yeah. Mike has always had a really long relationship with her. And so this one's only on DVD right now, but they restored it for the screening. Hmm. And so I want to believe that that means there has to be a Blu-ray coming soon. So...
I promise to watch it, Mike, as soon as there's a Blu-ray.
Please put it out, Bloody Disgusting Gang, because I would love nothing more. That's it for me. We have a lot to talk about.
See you have this disc of Malevolence 3.
Oh, okay.
I'm just curious because I thought that...
Have you ever heard of these movies?
I've heard you talk about Malevolence.
Yes.
It even made our 100, and it's still the only one I haven't seen on our 100.
Right.
And I will watch that one. But then I remember there being another movie that was called part of the trilogy, but it wasn't called Malevolence 2.
Bereavement.
Okay, part 2?
Which has now been renamed Malevolence 2.
Okay, so let's now it's a triple.
Let's delve into the trilogy, if you will.
Did I out saying I wasn't meant to...
No, I debated if I should bring it up this episode or not, or save it for the next one, but since we have a few minutes...
I'm curious.
Happy.
Yeah, the cover is interesting.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, so what happened was these are all written and directed by a Long Island filmmaker named Stephen Mena. And I met him when the first one came out back in about 2004, 2005. And I have a lot of personal history with the original movie because it was when I started Icons of Fright, which was kind of my entry into the horror world. And what happened was Anchor Bay put this out. They actually put it on a few screens across Long Island, so I got to see it on the big screen. And this is a time period for context where the last theatrical horror movies I saw were Aliens versus Predator and The Exorcist the Beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd given up, like, horror sucks, it's not good, blah, blah, blah. But then I saw a flyer at a comic book store for Malevolence, and I saw that it was Anchor Bay. And at that point, Anchor Bay had put out things like Madman and just these weirdo old school slashers. So I thought it was an old movie. I was like, oh, they're going to re-release an old movie. That's cool.
Yeah, cool, yeah.
But it wasn't. It was a brand new movie, and what I got with the first Malevolence, it's nothing. I love the experience. It doesn't do anything new. The best way I could describe it is it's Stephen's 2004 remake of what a modern Halloween should be, which means it's a heist film that crashes into a slasher.
Man, it sounds like he ripped off Rites of Spring.
Oh,
because I've heard that storyline before.
That's actually the opposite.
Oh yeah, no, yeah. I figured because Rites of Spring's later,
like,
right?
Shot for shot.
Yeah, well, that's the story. So,
but no. So the original movie that did that, by the way, is Malevolence, which deserves the credit for that story. Okay. And it's great. I mean, it's the execution, the score, the way it's shot, and again, it's not doing anything new, but it combines elements of, like, you know, Friday 13 too, because the killer wears like this sack mask, but with Halloween, with the music and the stingers and like just the execution of the way that the scares happen, right down to a little bit of Nightmare on Elm Street and Chainsaw. Like it's a really solid movie. And when I saw it, it was one of the few times I was able to take friends to go see it again and again, because I'm like, we have to go see this on the big screen. It's going to scare you, you know, let's go. And because he was Long Island, I just kind of stalked him. And in fact, it was funny, the killer helped us. He waited on us at TGI Fridays.
Oh, weird.
It was all this weird local thing. And so I stumbled on everybody. And Steven had said in interviews, I wrote this as a trilogy. Malevolence is the middle movie because it was the only one that I could afford to make. But there is a Bible and there's the story of what happens before that explains how the killer became the killer. And then the story after. And so he's like, if I ever get money and time, I will make all the movies. And so it took years, but he finally went back. And Bereavement is the prequel. And what's cool about the prequel is, I say you watch them in the order they came out, because if you know the twists of Malevolence, it makes it less fun.
Yeah.
But it's nice to see it and then go back to the prequel story and see how you got to that movie. You know, there's a lot of fun things about the. Just it's like a very intelligent rationalization of how like a Michael Myers could be Michael Myers. Right. And I'll tell you some more stuff off air.
White horse?
No white horse.
What?
No. Oh, but okay. For example, the character that becomes the killer has a disease that his nerve endings don't work. Huh. And so it's a rational explanation for why he doesn't feel anything when you stab at him or you're trying to fight back. Yeah. So it's like little subtle things like that are like, oh, that's really cool. Uh-huh. Bereavement also introduced the world to Alexandra Diodato. It's her very first movie.
Thank you.
And she's great in it. Yeah. And so he made that. And
I didn't even notice her in that one episode of True Detective. I don't know what you're
talking about. I'm sure you didn't, yeah.
Didn't even register.
And so there was he intended to make a third one after that, but it just kept not happening. Then he finally got to start shooting it 75% of the way in, and the lead actor tragically committed suicide.
Oh.
And so
the lead actor of the other two?
No, of this one, of this new one. And so, and you know, Adrian Barbeau, ironically enough, has a bit part in this as well.
Is Daddario in this one?
No, because that's the story movies ago.
Got it.
So he made this, he finally finished the third, he figured out a way to reshoot enough of it to finish this third movie. And here's the thing, again, with all that context I just told you, I love Malevolence. It's still one of my personal favorites, even though I will get why people won't dig it if they watch it at home. Like, I had the theatrical experience and I thought it was great. Bereavement's a more polished movie, but it's much darker and more fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
This one, I'm happy that he got to finish the trilogy, but it's impossible not to be a little disappointed because the budget constraints show. This movie doesn't look nearly as good as the first two. And I'm not really satisfied with the way that it wrapped up in the sense that, like, you have this great Bible, this great story that starts at the middle. Then you tell us this great story that's the beginning. And the third one's just kind of a slasher. And so if you set the bar low and you love these movies, I definitely think you should see it. Just because, again, I love the original. But I was honestly, I was a little disappointed with it.
Okay.
But what's good is he released all three of them on Blu-ray. So these literally just
I'm going to watch the first one because, I mean, not the first one, but in order, but I got to watch the actual film Malevolence.
Yeah. And I believe it's on Shudder.
Okay.
So,
I'll watch it there.
It's somehow streamable.
Okay.
So that's my 2 cents and I'm sticking to it.
At least you're honest. We're nothing if not honest here.
Well, let's take a break and we'll be right back.
Let's get spooky.
This week's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by Housewife, a new movie from RLJ Entertainment. After Holly meets with notorious cult leader Bruce O'Hara, she is led on a twisted journey of waking dreams that begin to unravel the fabric of her reality. Take a trip down the rabbit hole in this visually stunning film from the director of Baskin. Housewife is now available on DVD, VOD, and digital. You can get it on Amazon.com today. Okay, and welcome back to the show. We are very, very excited by our guest this week because it's one of my oldest and dearest friends from the Fangoria, pre-Fangoria days, I think. And
I didn't know any of this. I did not know this history went back to that.
Oh, God, yeah.
I had no idea.
Way back to MySpace, I believe, was where we met, possibly. And you were on Killer POV, our previous show. But not on Shockwaves yet, so welcome to Shockwaves, Axel Carolyn.
Hey.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
And we go back as far as Jump Cut and Trivia.
Oh, there you go.
So, that was our...
is actually 5 years, so it's...
Yeah, I know. It's actually significant.
Good God, we are getting old. I can't stand it anymore.
It moves fast.
But there is so much to talk about, and we will get to it, but basically what's exciting is that you have a little television show on this thing called Netflix. You might have heard of it.
Yeah.
Next week, Sabrina the Teenage Witch, which is kind of amazing. And you were one of the writers on that show.
I was, yeah.
Yes.
That was awesome.
And I even read one of the comics because somebody sent us the first comic and it's so good.
Oh,
the
yeah.
comics were so great. I'd never heard of it, to be honest, before I was approached to be a writer on this. And I tried to do my homework before I went to meet the showrunner. And I read all the comics at night and I was so excited.
Yeah.
Like, this is so good. It goes so dark. It's proper horror. It's really, I loved it. I kept thinking
that's what Riverdale was going to do into the Archie thing that they did.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess I kept thinking, oh, this is going to be a sleight of hand. One day it's just going to be that dark Archie thing and never happened. So now I'm excited because this, and also the casting of Sabrina is so perfect as one of the biggest fans of that movie, February.
Mm-hmm. Black Coat's Daughter.
Her performance in that was so great. And she was great in Mad Men. So it's awesome to see her get to develop.
And she's so different in this and so perfect.
Cool.
She's adorable as Sabrina. She's just
awesome.
Like, it felt like the room kind of fell in love with all the characters as we went, because we would see rushes every day and then we would see episodes when they were finished. And I felt like every time we were discussing, oh my God, Harvey is so wonderful. And oh my God, but Sabrina, I just want to protect her. Yeah, it was really cool. And Riverdale, I feel like, I think that's one of the things that Roberto, the showrunner, said when I first met him, was that he wanted to put so many horror references into Riverdale, but that he saved it for Sabrina. So he went more towards thrillers and those kinds of things for Riverdale.
So he's the showrunner of both shows?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. Interesting.
Is there any connection besides sharing a showrunner? Because I'm way behind on Riverdale, like a whole season, but I've You don't need to have seen it, but I've heard that they either did or they wanted to reference Sabrina on that show. So I don't know. I mean, because obviously that's a different network. This is Netflix. I don't know.
Sure.
Yeah, originally Sabrina is going to be on the CW too.
Yeah.
But then moved to Netflix, and I don't think they've planned any crossovers. And every once in a while, like, we know it's kind of the same universe. Like, Greendale is on the other side of Riverdale, like on the other side of the river. So we know that it's kind of vaguely the same universe. But it's not even – we don't even really know if it's the same timeline or like – that wasn't really discussed. It's possible,
I'm going to pretend it is just because I like shared universes.
So the comics do go way dark, way hard. Because the first one, the only one I read, I was like, oh, this is really
impressive.
It was
the first collection, right?
Yeah. It was something somebody gave us, and I remember just picking up one night,
And somebody can correct me on the timeline. Maybe you know in the research you did, but what I remember happening with the Archie comics is that Archie After Dark, Afterlife. Mm-hmm. Afterlife with Archie was the big, like, hey, let's take the Archie characters and put it in a zombie setting and kind of make it horror. Did Sabrina, this iteration of Sabrina, did that come after Afterlife with Archie?
I think so. I know that. So Roberto's kind of in charge of the creative side of Archie Comics, and he's written the comic book for Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, and he's written, I think it was Afterlife with Archie, and then there's two others that were written by someone else, Vampironica and something with Jughead as a werewolf, I think. And those have not been adapted.
He likes burgers.
But yeah.
That's all I know. Jughead. Cool.
Oh, very cool.
I can't imagine that one as a show, though, necessarily, but we'll see. Yeah.
It could be fun, though.
It could be.
Or as a feature or something.
Yeah.
I would love a one-off Jughead as a werewolf movie, quite frankly.
Yeah.
Afterlife with Archie is really cool because it goes really, really dark and it kills everybody.
Yeah,
and you're like, I mean, that is really appealing.
I dream of the last season of Riverdale being something like
that. That would be incredible if they're like, if they know the end is coming and they just turned it into Afterlife with Archie.
Yeah.
That'd be pretty rad. Because it's kind of morphed into a horror show. The last I dropped off, which I think was somewhere in the beginning of season two, it felt like it was becoming like a Scream type show or one of those type of shows. So I don't know how hard they went. But anyways, we will get back to Sabrina because I do want to talk about the differences between TV and feature films. But there's two things I want to ask you first. This one's a little bit of a curveball, but I have a blind spot when it comes to Hammer horror. And I have been on a massive Hammer marathon. So nice. I've watched this entire box set. I've got two more movies left in this one. I've ordered another box set, and I have the original UK one that's got like 21 discs in it or whatever.
Oh, is it the one with the cross?
Yes.
And like the box?
Yes, 100%. I have that one, yeah. And so as a fellow horror fan, and I think you do know quite a bit about the horror, I don't know why, I just missed this period growing up and never watched any of these films. What should I be looking forward to? What are the best Hammer horror films, your personal favorites?
Oh, dude, this is a vast topic.
All right.
I'm not a specialist. First of all, I'm mostly into gothic horror.
Like
the thrillers, I'm not very good at. I don't know them very well. I'm more into like the vampires and the creatures and all. But I'm sure you've seen all the ones that I really like.
Brides of Dracula is in the lead because Peter Cushing is so, I mean, he's great in everything, but he's so damn good at that movie.
He is, but I have a beef with the vampire in that one though.
Who doesn't? He's lame.
He's really lame.
But I do think that's the best looking of all the movies. Like, that's one of those movies that I never forgot. It was on TV, and I just remember watching it.
The movie itself.
Yeah, and I was mad because he wasn't Dracula, and I started watching it and going, wait a minute, this is really good. Like, this movie itself is probably better than most of the
Horror of Dracula is beautiful, though. It's just, that's one of my absolute favorites.
Yeah.
Horror of Dracula is incredible, and it takes some really interesting turns. Like, in the beginning, when you see why Jonathan Harker is in the castle, and you kind of like, wow, this is, I didn't see that coming. It gives it kind of a self-awareness that even though it was made in 1958, it still feels like it was very
Is that
very
the
fresh.
First Christopher Lee Dracula, House of Dracula? Because I get
Horror of Dracula. Yeah, Dracula in the UK and Horror of Dracula in the US. Yes.
Gotcha. Okay, because I have a blind spot with Christopher Lee as my Dracula as well. I've seen a few of them, but I've seen them out of order. And I think I saw the Jesse Franco one, which is, has no connection at all.
Yeah, that movie's
I was
crazy.
Like, wait a minute. I think I made a poor decision here.
Always start with Dracula 1972-80. Always.
I love that one.
That's actually pretty,
I love
that's
it.
Pretty
yeah.
funky.
It's really
the
funny.
The disco scenes.
The music's awesome.
Yeah,
it's really, yes, it's one of those that I saw as a teenager and I'm like, this is lame. And then I rewatched it over the years. And I'm like, this is one of my favorites.
Actually badass,
I love
it.
I love Dracula, Prince of Darkness is really good too.
Yeah.
And I think Warner Archive is doing Dracula AD 1972. It might have just come out. And then Satanic Rites of... Satanic Rites of Dracula, which I've never seen. But these are all, I don't know why this is, I try every couple of years. This is the year it's clicked. And I just can't get enough.
There's a bunch of vampire movies that don't have Christopher Lee and are really good. I really like Countess Dracula, which is not a vampire movie. So I'm kind of, it uses the name, but it's not. But Ingrid Pitt is just spectacular in that. There's The Vampire Lovers is pretty cool.
Oh, yeah, I have that one too.
What else? Oh, Kiss of the Vampire is really good.
I you know what? Is that on here? That's the one I just watched.
And it looks beautiful,
with
too.
With the cult of vampires going after the married couple.
It's so cool.
Yeah, that's a great one. Fun stuff. All right, so I'm on the right track then.
Yes.
I'm finding the good movies wonderful.
Even though you're not British.
Have you done all the Frankensteins?
You're not British, even though we're treating you like you came directly from the UK. You're a little north of the UK, right?
Come on.
I've lived 9 years in London.
Okay,
so
you're more
enough.
British than any of us.
Yeah.
Though I'm born under the Commonwealth, technically, so you still win.
All right. Well, we're on the right track with that. So you've written books before, but I have in front of me your latest book, which I bought in the UK at Fright Fest. It's the Fright Fest Guide to Ghost Movies, The Dark Heart of Cinema. So this is – explain this for – Fright Fest does these kind of collections, once a year?
Yeah. So Fright Fest is this horror festival in London that I've been attending since – very long, and if I said it would give away my age, which I'm not keen on. A long time.
You were
25. I've known them for a while.
Yeah.
And they started, I think 3 years ago, they started publishing those. Like every year they release a book through Fab Press, who do a lot of those amazing looking, kind of lavishly illustrated.
Nightmare USA and the Fulci book and all that great stuff.
They're so great. And the first one was exploitation movies. Alan Jones wrote that.
Oh, cool.
And then the second one was Michael Gingold, who wrote monster movies. And then I got to do Ghosts.
Oh, so this is number three. Cool.
Yes.
This is the third. Yeah.
Do they get released here?
Yeah.
They do, yes.
Okay, cool.
So
on Amazon right now for $20.
Okay.
Yeah, it's on Amazon, and it should be out. I think it should be in at least some bookstores, I hope, mid-November.
And this is it's actually really nicely comprehensive. It looks, because you can't see it at home, it looks gorgeous. So a lot of illustrations, a lot of the actual photos throughout. But also, like, I have a list of five movies that I really like, ghost movies I love, that are pretty deep dives to me, and all of them were in there.
They were?
Yeah, in the early stuff. So I was like, as soon as I see that, I wasn't testing it, but as soon as I see it, it just makes me go, yep, these are movies that I really like, and it's cool that you have those. And in the like last 20 pages, you have like really up-to-date new horror films.
So I try to go as up-to-date as possible. I also tried to be to go worldwide and to go as far back as possible, because the idea was to really show that this is a very universal phenomenon that's existed forever.
Yeah, I guess when you think about it, anything horror, it's probably the most classic
of cultures. I opened the book with this anecdote that's found from, a Latin philosopher. Who writes about this haunted house, and it's the plot of Poltergeist. It's the same thing. It's like we found the bones and we had to drop my water, and then I had to bury the bones, and then it puts the ghost to rest, and it's that kind of like the kind of story that you can still see today in any blockbuster. So
So before you're on, because I was meant to watch movies this week, but I watched Flanagan's series, you know, so and I saw somebody online. It was one of the funniest posts. I just saw somebody go, "Oh, is he?" Somebody from our kind of world, and he posted, "Oh, is Mike Flanagan's new show as big a train wreck as I'm hearing online?" And I just looked at the tweet, like, what? I have yet to hear a single negative thing. So I was like halfway through, going, "No," and let me finish this first. And then I finished it. I'm utterly the last episode. I'm utterly destroyed. I think it's one of the most mature, moving pieces of filmmaking I've seen in a very long time.
It's phenomenal.
Especially for adults, like actual people who like want characters to give a shit about. But it also fits so well in line with a lot of these movies when I think about what it's really about, you know, grief and trauma and thinking about loved ones, right? Which is what all good ghost stories tend to have as their
backbone. One of the things I like the most about those kinds of movies is that there's so much, it's the perfect metaphor for so many things, and you can talk about pretty dark stuff, but you do it under cover of the supernatural, and you can use the supernatural as something that's comfortable and it gives you comfort because there's an afterlife, or you can use it as something scary because we don't know what comes afterwards, or there's so many different ways of spinning this, and it's all about humans and human emotions and characters, and yeah, you're right, like Haunting of Hill House I thought was phenomenal. We
pretty much know there isn't like werewolves, like we pretty much 100%.
We think,
and we know there isn't vampires in the way we think of them. There's probably
outside
people
of the goth circle,
but most of the monsters that we love in terms of our horror, you can almost discount 100%. So it's like a very safe thing. I think ghost stories, ghost movies have been the only ones to ever really scare me. Like to be honest, and I don't mean scare, but like more like unnerve. Mm-hmm. And it's because we just don't know anything. We don't know anything about the afterlife. No one knows anything. Doesn't matter if you're a philosopher.
Everyone,
a baby.
Everyone you know has some kind of ghost story, exactly. Right? We all have something that's happened to someone we know.
And even people who don't believe will tell you. I think I told it way back when, but like my mother told me the story, and it's like she doesn't believe in any of that, doesn't believe in ghosts, and yet she has a story that is so real that it gives you I'm scared to even talk about it because it came from a non-believer. If it came from someone who's like, I believe in ghosts, then you're like, whatever. But when somebody shares shit with that leaves you a little, because we don't know what happens. So I feel like ghosts as a genre in horror is so cool because it's like people trying to figure out, work out what it could be. And you could go a million ways. And you did yourself with your own movie, Soulmate, which like really looks at like relationships and things like that, which I thought was really cool. It wasn't just a throwaway stock kind of horror film.
That was really meant to be kind of – I love the idea of if there's ghosts, there's something comfortable about. I don't have faith, so I don't believe that there's a heaven.
Yeah.
But I kind of, you know, anytime you lose someone close, you'd like to think that they're not entirely gone. And I don't have that belief. So I've always felt like horror movies and especially ghost movies were my way of kind of connecting with that idea that maybe there's still something, maybe you're still out there. And I found that, you know, sometimes when I've had family members who've passed on, and I've somehow the idea that they might be ghosts somewhere, I found that weirdly. I don't know. I kind of find that comforting. So that was the idea that was behind
energy. I feel like people are energy, and it's like I don't believe in it either. I don't know what happens after. I don't believe in heaven, but I believe in energy. And there's certain things that are just inexplicable, especially when it comes to loved ones, where you just feel like, man, I don't know. Their energy feels like it's still sort of here somehow.
Mm-hmm.
So ghost stories. I think. I mean, I've always said my biggest fears are drowning in Home Invasion, yeah. which is why I don't like watching those in movies. But ghost stories definitely, they're the one genre of horror that really messes with your head. And you were saying before Axel got here that you, for the first time in years, had nightmares because of The Haunting of Hill House.
Yeah, I was telling him, like, it wasn't that it was scaring me, the show. It's not that scary, right? It's more like a feeling. But like, I watched a few in a row, and that night I had these very vivid dreams, and the house was kind of shaky because of wind, and I just kind of was creeped out. And that's the first time, because it's unsettling. Because, I mean, the good thing about the show does what you were just talking about, which is there's that feeling of there's good potential in ghosts, and mm-hmm. there's also the negative. Mm-hmm. And that, but just like life, there's good people and yeah. there's terrible yeah. people. So it's not that surprising.
I remember reading this Time Life book when I was little about ghosts and apparitions, and I remember this story of, like, sometimes you can see a loved one show up and they're not supposed to be there, and it's exactly at the time that they died on the other side of the planet. And I've always thought that was fascinating. And that idea of ghosts being premonition is kind of explored in Haunting of Hill House, and the way that kind of wrecked me. Yeah. That revolution yeah. just totally
I think
me.
You're right about that we have intuition with people, and that's energy. And so who yeah. knows what mm-hmm. it is, but I do think we tend to know, or you suddenly think of someone you haven't thought of a long time, and then you find out they had just died or something. I think we've all had something like that. And so mm-hmm. it's so much of our psychic abilities, in quote marks, is unexplained to us. You know, I was telling you, like, when I was in Knoxville, I got all creeped out because I was walking home from one of those parties. I told you the next day.
Yeah, yeah.
And literally, when I was dark night, didn't really know where I was going. And every time I'd get directly under a light post, it went out. That second I went under, it happened twice in a row. So I said consciously in my mind, and I was kind of creeped out, I said, if that third one, as I looked ahead, turns off, I'm actually going to be scared. I walked under and it turned off, and I actually stopped and I looked around the street, and everything, you noticed every crackling of yeah. It was like one of those moments. And I told years ago that does happen to me quite a lot, like yeah. just not as much as that time it did, where I walk under things and you're like, what is that? Just energy? We had Tom McLaughlin on an old Killer POV, and I asked him about this because he's into energy stuff. He was yeah. into, I don't know, he explained some sort of psychic phenomena that he had gotten really interested in. And mm. and he said it was a thing that he had heard of, like this thing that certain people get. And I was like, oh, that's so weird.
So your magic powers that you switch lamps.
I have the most useless X-Factor X-Men power. It's like occasionally I can turn off lampposts unwittingly. I don't know if that does me much good. But it does make you go, or is somebody looking out for you, or some yeah. relative there? It's trying to signal you. You have no idea.
The great unknown, man. It's to me, it's like the scariest thing is not having that answer at all. But again, when yeah. I watch these kind of films, that's when you go to bed and you hit all the lights off and you're just sitting there and you can't go to sleep. Like that's when it plays with your head.
Yeah.
Oh, Hill House had a jump scare that actually made me jump. And that never happens, yeah. and it did. Like there's
and
one
you know why? I think it's
because
they don't do many.
Killed me.
I was telling him yeah. there's almost no jump scares in it because that's not the kind. So it means if you save it, mm-hmm. it's yeah. going
to
be.
And 30 seconds after that jump scare, there's this monologue that just brought me to tears. Yeah. I'm like, what the hell? Stop
now, I
playing
the
with
last
my
time
emotions.
Where you could, yeah, you get emotions from people, and it's like to me that's what I want from an experience. I don't want every film to be like this. This mature in some ways because it's nice to have other stuff that's made all over the map. But to get that a once in a while is special. Like. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It had great payoff to me.
Yeah. All right. So I'm curious because you had done another book, It Lives Again, Horror Movies in the New Millennium, mm-hmm. which is that still in print or is that
oh,
a tough one
so.
To get at this
no,
point?
I think that's gone. It was like 2007, I think.
Oh, wow.
It
you
was
can
very
get
much
Odyssey
time,
books, I'm sure. I'm just guessing. They probably have one copy just sitting there somehow.
Well, I have guess. One on my bookshelf. Yeah. But so when it comes to approaching this book, how much time, and I remember you telling me about it vaguely mm-hmm. like a year or so ago. So how much time does it take to put together a comprehensive list like this? And was there any criteria or anything that you set for yourself? Because what I like about it, I left Fright Fest and I skimmed through it and read through it the first time on the long train ride to Paris, which was lovely.
Nice.
But I like it goes in chronological order.
Yeah.
So you go year by year. And there's so many films I'd never even heard of. So what's the research? Do you watch all these?
I've seen all of them. Yeah.
You've seen them all. Okay.
I've seen them all. I hadn't seen them all before I started the book. So the idea is that I needed 200 titles. That was kind of the standard for those uh-huh. books. And I was supposed to submit the list and have it approved. And so there was a little bit of back and forth with the publisher who always wanted to encourage me. At first, it was super heavy, like towards the 2000s and from 2000 to now, because there's so many films that came out since and so many ghost movies. Yeah. And then he wanted it to be a little bit more international, a little bit more over a period of time. And so I had to include a ton of titles I'd never even heard of. And some of those are super hard to find. Like some of those, there's one I watched that doesn't even have an English title and it's Indian. And I've only watched it. I couldn't find it with subtitles. Uh-huh. And it's just, it was really hard to understand what the hell was going on. So I kind of, that's the one where the review, they're not really reviews, but they're more like facts. But it kind of goes more towards like, here's what I know about Indian cinema and how they deal with ghosts. And it's not specifically about that movie. But the movie is from the 70s and it's kind of one of those seminal
movies.
What's
that one called? I don't know.
Oh my God. It's.
Oh, we'll find it.
It's, yeah, I can find it if I look at it.
Oh, from the
70s,
you said.
Super complicated. Yeah.
We're handing her the book just so for those listening at home.
But now that we know you've seen 200, we've got a question about each one. trivia, because you like trivia.
Yeah, we're going to go
live on air.
It's called Ayuram Jenmangal.
Oh, okay, now it makes more sense why you couldn't just directly recall that.
Sure.
Good luck. Good luck with that one.
Well, that will be a trivia question for Dead Right people. Pay attention. Well, we're one thing we're always excited about, because I think the whole point of this show is discovering hidden gems that you didn't know about, or that's what we're always trying to recommend people. Mm-hmm. What were some of the ones that you personally were like, oh, this is a really cool discovery, or even rediscovery for yourself?
Well, I'm embarrassed to admit that I'd never seen Kill Baby Kill.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And that was phenomenal. Yeah. The Mario Bava, and it looks beautiful.
Oh, the new, it's so gorgeous, yeah.
It's and they released a new Blu-ray, I think, last year, so it was just around the time that I discovered it. So I saw it, and then I immediately had to buy it because I thought it was just so good, and I rewatched it the second I had the Blu-ray. It's stunning. It really is. And then there's another one that I keep recommending that's called The Ghost of Yotsuya from 1958.
Oh. Ooh.
I think.
Pull that one up because I haven't heard of that one.
Yeah,
wait, actually, you have it up.
Do I?
Oh, that's Kasane. Another one.
No, Kasane.
Yeah. And there's two Yotsuyas. There's one from the end of the 40s because it's a very well-known kwaidan, kind of traditional ghost story. And there's one from the end of the 50s, and it's like the first half is just this. That's the old one, I think.
Oh, there's a new
it's
one?
It's a fully, it's kind of inspired by Hammer movies, so it's Eastman colors. It looks beautiful. It's stunning. And the first half is kind of a traditional-ish samurai movie, and at some point it takes this dark turn, and it turns into something very close to J-horror, to what we know now, like the long-haired ghosts kind of showing up. It's awesome. It's really cool.
Oh, yeah, that looks really interesting. Did you now? How familiar were you with, obviously your own film was a ghost film, but how familiar with this 200 list were you otherwise? Like, was this still pretty? This is like the best place for your wheelhouse, or are there other topics you would have been even easier?
No, this
to,
is definitely this my is, okay, yeah. This is my taste. For
I figured it was because I knew you were into gothic, and I
And I pitched it to them. I went in and I was like, I want to do ghosts because that has to be mine. And it was just such a great excuse to discover all those titles and to do all the research. And so for almost a year, I would every morning. I would wake up, I would watch or rewatch a movie, and then I'd write the little piece that goes with it. And every time it's like 200 words, so it's pretty easy. So by breakfast time, I would have written my piece for the day, and it was so much fun.
What a gig, man. I'm going to wake up and watch a ghost story right about it. But I love that you include things like The Ghost and Mr. Chicken, which is one of my favorite movies, Don Knotts.
Yeah, it's not just horror. It really is like an overview of ghosts in general.
I think Casper's in here as well.
Yes. I'd never seen it.
Oh, wow.
What about
Scare Jessica to Death?
Yeah, so that's on my absolute favorite on my list that I was making. What about post-2000? Are there any that, like, watching them that you were surprised by that they held up or they were particularly good? Because, I mean, a lot of us would probably feel like we've seen them, but there's also a lot that are probably kind of junky on retrospect.
Remember. I just know that I watched The Devil's Backbone for the 50th time, and I thought it was still beautiful and still wonderful.
Yeah.
I don't know. Some of my favorites are from that time, but there's some that...
But there was a
Most
lot because of Ring. I think after The Ring, there was a lot of films happening.
Yes, it really opened the floodgates. And The Sixth Sense, obviously, and all those kind of Stir of Echoes I love.
Which I much prefer that period to like the post-Saw, to Hostel stuff. You know what I mean? I much prefer that to the torture porn stuff, so I didn't mind that there was lots. But I'm always looking for like, because I'm seeing, Baby's Room's one that Becca really liked. I remember that. Mm-hmm. I still haven't seen that one.
Grave Dancers, Mike Mendez.
Yes.
The Unseen.
And he made you put that in there?
Didn't even buy me a beer.
Yeah,
man.
It's
come on,
too
Mike.
Late.
Step up. Yeah, we talked. We talked about The Convent earlier in the show because I got a chance to see it on the big screen last week. But yeah, no, this is really terrific. And every time I look at it, I'm just like, oh crap, I got to find that Haunted 3D. I don't know what that is, but 3D, I'm in. Innkeepers, wow.
I love The Innkeepers.
Yeah, Ghost Graduation. So it's from Spain.
Yeah, it's very funny. I recommend that one.
I think like this
I wouldn't wholeheartedly recommend every single title in this book, I'll admit. But that wasn't the point. The point was really to give an overview of it. And then if you can find it, just go and find it.
And how difficult is it to write about your own film?
Because that was the worst.
I just stumbled on Soulmate in here, which is kind of hilarious.
That was the worst.
You should have had like one person write just that one.
I was hoping that someone else was going to write that. And then I was going to ask someone else to write about Tales of Halloween. And eventually it ended up being too complicated. I had to explain how it just, I just did it myself.
I just love guides like this. I know you're all about this too.
It's when it's pictures. It's like, that's my thing. It's like, I actually like that you don't overwrite, because there's so much writing on the internet. If I want to read a much longer deep dive, I can do that. But if I'm going to buy this thing and look at it all the time, I want to be able to look at it, reference the year and stuff, and get a summary of how you felt. So to me, this is like the perfect kind of compendium. And also another one of my favorites, Burnt Offerings, is utterly bonkers and just such a strange haunted house movie. That's the other difference. It's a subgenre of that is haunted house movies versus just ghost movies. There's a lot of ghost movies that don't, but haunted house movies are their own thing, because there's something about the house that just, I guess, freaks us all out, our own homes, you know? Yeah. I find that so bizarre.
And just finding the criteria was kind of hard, because some of those movies are not technically, I guess Poltergeist is not really a ghost, but it's or the entity is in there, and that's not really a ghost. It's kind of a different...
I guess I don't know what the difference is, because I view anything that's apparition or spirits all as ghosts.
Well, but, I define the ghost as... what did I? It's in the introduction. I can't remember exactly, but it's basically
narrator
it's
Rob.
Kind of,
please give us the introduction. Yes, we would.
No, I'm not going to read the introduction.
It's at the end of the introduction, but it's the manifestation of a person that used to exist. So it shouldn't be a demon, or it shouldn't be.
This is your biography. Yeah, hold on. Where's your introduction?
But then I kind of, every once in a while, I was like, if this movie functions like a haunted house movie or like a ghost movie, then I would include it.
Well, let me tell you, one of the joys that I got when I bought this, because you were signing it at Fright Fest, I could have waited for you to come here. But no, I went all the way to London just to get you to sign it. But you're sitting next to this gentleman, and it's just like, oh, you want me to sign the book too? And I was like, sure, whatever, dude. And it was the guy from Ghost Stories. And I was like, oh, as soon as he introduced me, I was like, oh my God, I love your movie. And
you created the main guy or the creator?
Andy Nyman,
Oh, wow. Andy Nyman, just sitting right next to her.
Co-directed and stars.
Let's bring that up, because
because it's a great movie.
Yes, and so let me know. Well, and this is the beef I'm having. I saw Dick post about it a couple days ago, and he was like, "This is so great." And I just wrote to him, texted him right after, and I said, "Look, man, this is probably the most underrated movie that came out this year in terms of horror." And so, but in the UK, it wasn't. In the UK, it did gangbuster. Here in America, I feel like so many people can only see where it lands and then kind of can't take the whole picture. And I want to say this spoiler free, because I still want people to discover. And
you mean the ending taints their image of the whole film?
From a lot of conversations I've had, I've seen so few people talking about this movie.
Yeah.
No, and I remember when you talked about
it. That was my beef with it, but I still appreciate and like the whole movie.
The individual stories are so good.
When you rewatch it, it doesn't affect the way that you go through it. Like, if you know the ending of... it's not
Sixth
entirely...
Sense,
but,
or
the others. You rewatch it, and it changes the way you look at things, because it doesn't make it scary anymore. It makes it a different kind of unsettling, but it's not the same kind of scary. I feel like even if you know how ghost stories end, it's actually really interesting to go and see how it ties together. And it doesn't make it less scary.
Each one of the stories are like the story of the guy who has to work at that place.
Oh,
the light. I think that was the scariest movie I saw this year. Like, that part was, to me, like sitting in a theater, and there's like, I think it's a mop, and in the background,
God,
and you're just sure it's this demon woman. I'm sitting there going, ugh.
We saw it together, right?
I think we saw it at different days, but it was at the same festival.
Yeah, yeah.
But I really think it's a terrific, so if people haven't gone there yet, but that's one that, like, and I remember seeing that you would like it too, so I was like, okay, good. So I'm not just crazy. This is a really great piece. Mm-hmm. Did you ever happen to see that? Because I had heard that it's an amazing theater.
I saw the play.
So
yeah.
Tell me a little about that, because people said it was incredibly cinematic.
Yes, it was a while ago. So so telling you all the differences between that and the film is hard.
No, I'm just curious how it felt. Yeah,
it was so great, because it was in this little theater in the West End in London, and you would go in, and from the moment you'd go in, there'd be like flickering lights and like caution tape on the sides, and make it look like some weird shit had happened, and they would do everything to unsettle you from the moment you walked in. So it was really, really cool, and there was so much advertisement that said that this was the scariest thing you could see, that people were almost scared just walking in.
Oh,
so
that is good.
There was that atmosphere from the start, and it was beautifully done, and it was very simple, simple effects, and it was kind of, as I recall, Andy was playing the character that kind of linked the stories together, and it was this I remember some kind of professor talking to the audience and then explaining the stories. Mm-hmm. And even that kind of brought the atmosphere, just made it. It's
like,
yeah,
a campfire ghost story.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would have loved it because I was sitting next to someone who had seen
they're
it.
They're redoing it, actually. Awesome. I think they're bringing it back. But oh. I think it's going to be in the UK. But
okay.
I seem to recall seeing that they're bringing it back around Christmas time or next year.
So I'd have to go back to the UK.
Yeah, there you go.
Bummer.
You know, I didn't have that great a time. But so did you have a list that you wanted to read off?
I mean, I don't know.
You're the list man.
I didn't think too. I was just pulling ones people will have heard me talk. But there were, like I said, most, I think all of them were in the Let's Scare Jessica to Death, which I've talked about a lot this year. But I just think
arguably
it's
a vampire movie.
There's a vampiric quality to it. But I think any kind of evil entity tends to be vampiric. So this one feels a little more little. But it's definitely a ghost story with the old photos. And, you know, it's got a lot of those tropes.
It's one of those where it kind of took that liberty because I felt like exactly it functions kind of like a ghost story. But there's also the Chinese vampires in some of the movies that I decided to include because they're very loose on the definition of whether it's a ghost, it's a vampire, it's a living dead. Like Encounters of the Spooky Kind, I think, is in there. And I love that movie.
I haven't seen that one. I got to see that. Obviously, The Changeling, which this year has had such a beautiful release. And again, like Mike Flanagan's series, it is that very adult-driven horror. It's, you know, with loss and a great movie. The Entity was on there because I just the power of that first half. I think it's, you know, the last act of that movie to me is not as interesting when it becomes a big science experiment.
I haven't revisited it since that was the
it's
movie.
It's not an easy watch. It's not a, you know.
Since I was a little kid that scared me more than The Exorcist, and I've never gone back to it.
It has that similar intensity.
But I just never have the courage to watch it.
And also Barbara Hershey's so lovely. She's not someone you want to see bad things happening. But you know, that's the power of that one. There's two. So two that were on, both in your book. One that I would have really, I would have been like recommending you if I knew you're writing is The Haunting of Julia Full Circle. So that's in there, which is great because and that's finally on Amazon this last few months on HD so people can see it. And it's just a really beautiful, quiet, creepy fucking movie. Yeah. Like there's a creepy core to that thing.
It's very much like Let's Scare Jessica to Death in that it's around that time in the UK and in the US in the 70s. If you look, every single ghost story starts with this woman had a breakdown following the death of her son, and she's just come out of this mental institution, and her husband doesn't believe that she's seeing things, but she is every single one of them.
Totally my favorite subgenre is crazy woman.
Hysterical women
hysterical
seeing weird
woman. Shit. Yeah. That's pretty funny. But yeah, I mean, well, this has one of the all-timers of worst deaths to a minor imaginable. You're just at a breakfast table and the kid starts choking on a cornflake and it's just like so brutal to watch. So I see why she went crazy. That's not then obviously The Fog I think is a really neat classical for an American film. It feels a little more classic. And then the one that I was most excited to see in there was one that I got from Darren Scott and I love it. And so it's also your Baba, which is The Whip in the Body.
Yes.
That movie when I start and I mean it's not just the kinky stuff. The kinky stuff's really interesting. But it's actually the ghosts. It's one of the closest I've ever seen to what I feel like a ghost scene should feel like, which is, you know, the presence is there and then you go in there and you just feel like you see kind of maybe wet footprints or something. And it's just saying spooky. Baba's so good at atmosphere.
It's very subtle too. Yeah. It's not in your face. Like there's a ghost. It's very much hints. And
it's about obsession and this like very dark sadomasochistic relationship in the afterlife. So that's a movie that really took me by surprise because I thought it was a Hammer film for a long time. It's definitely inspired by the Hammer films, but it was Baba. Baba's just, he's a beautiful technician, you know, as well as an artist, but he knew how to construct things.
And Christopher Lee?
Yeah, Christopher Lee being the kinkiest fuck Lee he's ever been, you know? It's like, you want this whip? You know, it's like, oh, now I do. You know, it's like, but that. So all of those were in there. So and I made all of that. Those were my picks before I got here. So it was nice to see that this is like a nice deep dive. So, but yeah, they're. It's interesting when there's nothing like I like to scan these because I'm sure I'll find at least a few that I won't know and are good. So that's always important if any kind of guide.
Yeah.
I was doing that with that weird book. Remember that one I had?
The weird one.
It was like 300 weirdest. Yeah. And I've got this list of like 30 things, and some will be terrible, I bet.
What I'm hoping the most is that people discover stuff and that they hit me up on Twitter and they tell me, why did you make me watch this? Yeah. Or on the other hand, like, wow, I discovered this classic. This is awesome.
So, and all the Casper fan club will come.
I love that your books always have like almost every other page is what is it, that term, dog-eared?
Yeah, dog-eared.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that post-its weird, or whatever. That
yeah,
one,
the
yeah,
weird
that
book
is, yeah.
was just like literally every page had like a thing yeah, on it. Yeah. I was like, are you really going to go through all? I was like, yep.
Yeah, and then I just write them all down. But I think if I had seen it all by now, I'd give up on doing what we do. I still do it because it's like, oh, you might find that one thing.
Yeah, the one gem.
Yeah, that's
yeah. I was saying that horror movie fans are the most optimistic people in the world.
Oh
yeah,
we absolutely are.
Because
yeah, yeah.
we wade through all the bullshit to try to get that one gem. And it's not the same for everybody. So even if someone recommends you something, you still don't know if it's going to be good or not.
As we like to say on the show, even Microwave Massacre is somebody's favorite movie. Not this guy's, but somebody's. I want to see that guy who's got the poster above his bed. And it's like, I love that. I collect everything. It's my possession.
He might have an office here. It might be Ryan Turner.
Oh, my God. I hate to think. It's his Blood Hook or whatever it was.
Oh, he loves Blood Hook. Blood Hook. I liked it, but I didn't love it as much as him. He loves his Doom Asylum thing, which I think is madness.
Pure
I saw they kept playing the trailer at Fredfest actually.
Oh yeah,
before some of the movies, and it was like, what the hell is this? And
was it maybe it was an Arrow? Maybe Arrow.
Oh yeah, because Arrow is the sponsor. Yeah, they were the sponsor of that. That's why. That's ridiculous.
That is pure crazy.
So let's talk about Sabrina and kind of because this is. I mean, I always like to hear. I mean, look, I'm in acquisitions now. I never thought I'd be in this position ever. Like you end up in interesting spots and then realize that, oh wow, I'm actually really good at this particular position. And so I don't, at least when I knew you a few years ago, I'd never even heard you say the word like, yes, I want to write TV. Or at least I don't think.
No, I never thought of it.
And so I never thought that you'd be in this position, but I think it's a great position to be in.
Yeah.
And so how did we get here? And I guess my question is kind of like, I think every time you put your heart and soul into a movie, you hope for the best and hope for a success, but it's almost like starting over every time. Mm-hmm. Like as soon as it's out, you got to go up that hill again.
Despite all those big hits that I've had over the years.
But so tell us about, post Soulmate and then doing Tales and how that led. Why did that lead to TV? And how did this all happen?
Well, the thing is, I've always kind of like the idea of seizing whatever opportunity shows up. Because as a filmmaker, even if you know that you want to, first of all, I found it very hard when I was starting out to tell people that I wanted to direct or that I wanted to write, because I felt like that's what everybody wants to do. And when you say that, everybody thinks, well, yeah, take your place in the line. And I was more like, I want to work in horror somehow. I want to do something, but I didn't know what. But I was always writing. Uh-huh. And I kind of knew that being a director would be awesome, but wasn't really confident enough to say it. But I did every job that I was offered. Like I worked in film PR. I worked in film financing. I acted very badly for a little while. But it was just kind of opportunities that showed up. It was literally just someone was like, hey, do you want to be in my short film? Do you want to do this? And it was just, I always felt like every single opportunity to learn something more about film was going to be interesting and at some point it was going to pay off. And it's kind of the same way that this happened, actually. So I did Soulmate. Soulmate was a script that I wrote not necessarily thinking I was going to be directing it. And then I kind of felt like it was so personal that I wanted to do it myself. But originally it was going to be other people. And then that didn't really happen. And then I was going to make it for a pretty big budget. And Olga Korolenko was going to be in it. And then that didn't happen. That collapsed like 2 weeks before shooting. And it broke my heart. And then it eventually happened. And it was this tiny budget. It says on IMDb it's $600,000. I'm like, I wish I had a third of that. I don't know who put that up, but I'm like, no, nowhere near. But it was cool because it got some attention. It did pretty well in the UK on DVD. And then I moved here. And unfortunately, like the moment I could have kind of capitalized on that and gone back to the same people, maybe, or the same crew, I moved to the US. And so I had to rebuild everything. But the cool thing was that I knew all those filmmakers and all those people I was friends with, like Mike Mendez or like Ryan Schifrin or like, and I wanted to bring everybody together. So we did Tales of Halloween together, which was a phenomenal experience that came out, I think, 3 years ago.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
And when you guys finished making that, I have to assume you guys thought about doing a sequel to it at some point, but it just never, it's too hard to get all those people band back together.
We got away with it and managed to remain friends, and I'm not sure how many times we can do that. And it really was like working amongst friends, and it's not like anybody was making the big bucks, so it's kind
of... No, I remember being on sets of a couple of those, seeing how they really did seem like they're being made for very little. Like, that's, it was pretty impressive.
It was, yeah, we had what we needed to make decent short films, but it was not like it was in plush, and it was and mostly all the pre-production was like hanging out in the backyard at my place, and it was kind of, you know, it's hard to put people together in those circumstances. Yeah, or Jump Cut, the first meeting with Jump Cut.
We lent you our my favorite Halloween decorations.
Yes.
Which are these old-timey decorations that are actually on my mantle right now. But they're my favorite.
So yeah, they're in my episode.
They're in your
right.
episode. So Alex Esso is really good in that, too.
Yeah.
It's creepy. And that the she's one shot's super creepy with the on the street where she's walking, the shadow comes up. I like that. That's a good moment.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was super fun to do. But it was one of those things, like, again, that just happened. It just seemed to be an opportunity. I pitched it to the other guys. Everybody liked it. We pitched it to Epic. Epic wanted to do it right away. Like, they came on board the moment we pitched it. And then we were off to races. And that almost never happens. So it was very lucky. Mm. And then I spent the next 3 years, I guess, writing. Mm. Writing stuff for myself. Writing stuff that I was hired to write. And then writing Sabrina. And Sabrina just kind of same thing. It was like one day I get a call from my manager who was just like, have you heard of Chilling Adventures of Sabrina? They sent a pilot that I'd written that they liked. And when it was time to staff, they were like, oh, this woman, because she's written that. And so she asked, are you free tomorrow? Can you meet with Roberto? It's about Chilling Adventures of Sabrina. Like, okay, I better read those comic books. Yeah. And I met Roberto the next day. And I got the call like 2 hours later just saying, you're going to be on it.
Wow.
You start on Monday. And
that's
I
crazy.
Started the, yeah.
Hmm. That's cool. What was it like walking? Because you had been writing for years, your own material, doing stuff for other people. But I'm always fascinated by the writer's room. And like I fell in love with it when I was doing the Dexter podcast with Scott because I met all the writers and they were so terrific. So what was it a little – was it a almost kind of like a little adjusting to now there's 10 people in the room, or I'm assuming it's about 10 people. How does that whole process work?
Well, it's 10 for this one, so you're right. It's so interesting and it's so weird and different. And it was, on the one hand, it's super fun. On the other hand, when you're a filmmaker and you're used to having ownership of stuff, there's a little bit of letting go that needs to happen. And the first couple of weeks for me it was a little bit of an adjustment because I'd go home thinking, oh, we haven't solved this problem. And I'd feel like it was on me, but it's not. It's not. It's on the room. It's on the showrunner. It's on, you know, it's a collective process. So it's a very, very different way of thinking. And I listened to tons of podcasts about writers' rooms and tried to figure out how to navigate the kind of political side of things and who speaks when and how. And you know, and the one thing that people don't really tell you that's so essential is that you're not there. Of course, you're there to make the best show you can possibly make. But that call is not yours. You're there to serve the vision of someone else. And that person is the showrunner. And they're the only person, kind of like the director on set, they're the only person who knows exactly the full picture and knows exactly how everything is supposed to pan out. So whatever decision they make, even if you think, but that idea was so much cooler, you realize very quickly if it's a good showrunner, which was definitely the case here, you can trust that they know that they've made that decision knowing it's going to pay off and you had no idea how. And that was really interesting. And I think that I kind of caught up to that pretty quickly. But you realize throughout the season that that always happens, and it's you just have to trust that this person is going to make the right decisions, and then when they do, you're kind of like, it's amazing. It's like a magic trick. Like, this is so cool.
I was talking to a guy who's actually teaching a class on Writer's Room because he spent 20 years in Writer's Room, and what surprised me talking to him was because I assumed, oh, it's like 10 writers, and this is your episode, and then and then he's like, no.
Some are like that.
I'm sure, but he was like, no, in the Writer's Room's eyes, and there'd be some guy who's never even written anything. All he's there for is he's really good for one joke every episode. He's a joke guy. And he's in the room. And so when I start hearing that, oh man, I think I'd be really great to just be in a writer's room just for that idea. And that's it. I don't want to be sitting there to write all the episode. But it was interesting to hear how it's more like a kind of like an orchestra that you're trying to find a balance of types and things, like which I don't know if that's every writer's room, but what was the experience of this one in that way?
It seems like again, it all hinges on the showrunner and they set the tone and they decide what they need because they're the ones who need to deliver. So they decide how many writers they want and they decide what they're looking for in writers. I was very clearly the horror chick. I knew that. I think my manager mentioned that I watched a horror movie every day. And and he mentioned that to me in my interview. And I was like, do I? I don't think I do. And then I started Letterboxd. And I'm like, yeah, I kind of do. Yeah.
And there's this book to prove it. So there you go. 200 titles right here.
Your life. Yeah.
Yeah. But it was, and it's fun because people quickly kind of learn what your strengths are. So we would sometimes assign scenes to people and very quickly we'd realize this guy's really good at this voice for this character. Or like I'm kind of, my strength is usually building scares or kind of writing creepy stuff or action. And so you learn, it's really interesting. It's a really different
process. It sounds like a totally collaborative sort of thing.
It is, yeah.
So there's 10 writers. Do you, how much time is spent before you actually write something? Like my memory or what I think I know of Writer's Room is that everyone is talking out and hashing out what the entire season is going to be, mm-hmm. like on a giant board before you even go to script.
Yeah.
So how long is that process, like hashing out and talking what we're going to see throughout the 10 episodes or whatever it is?
I think, again, it depends from room to room because I recently had an interview where I mentioned we had 6 months for that first season. And they were like, what? We're lucky if we get 6 weeks. Okay. I don't know how you guys deal with it.
Yeah.
But we had... I think they kind of stuff started in the summer. I started in January, and we talked through stuff. The pilot had been written by Roberto, and he was on the way to writing the second episode. So the work was really starting episode 3. And but we also had to discuss the world and the season and try to figure out where this was going. And I think that was like the first month,
was
maybe?
Was the Spine the comic?
No.
Okay.
The comic was the... tone, I think.
Ah, interesting.
But the story went in different ways. You can't really follow that closely.
So if somebody's read the comic out there, they haven't seen this
story. No, they haven't seen
it. Oh, that's
it.
Cool.
No, no, no,
that's
no.
good to know for people.
Yeah. You can read the comics and not have anything spoiled. Cool. And it's still the same world, and you'll feel like it's very much the same kind of characters, but it's not even the same, totally the same characters, because you discover that as you go, and it's so cool to see those characters kind of come to life. Like I said, it's like you watch The Rushes, and you're like, oh my God, this, it works. How did it work?
Wow.
Oh, that's a lot of fun.
Yeah. There's a lot of it, because I know, at least from usually a lot of the episodes are written in advance, especially for something like Netflix, which is intended to be, but they still shoot them individually as episodes. Does a lot of change happen once you start seeing a little bit of footage? Like, you guys write all, like, whatever. How many
Not
episodes
really.
Is it? Ten or
something? Yeah.
It's 10 episodes. So when you start seeing episodes 1 come in and 2, does that affect the later episodes, like episode 9 and 10.
Really. I don't think so. I mean, maybe Roberto did some adjustments that he didn't necessarily talk about, or it's little things. Sometimes it's just like discover that Kiernan, who plays Sabrina, is allergic to the cat. It's a little bit of a, okay, that's not right too many scenes where she's petting him. But it's little funny. Things like that, but otherwise it's not really... no, you kind of, by the time we saw the pilot, I think we were writing episode 6. Wow. So you're well underway by that point.
Wow.
And do you think writing in a writer's room for a Netflix show, the way that Netflix distributes and stuff, do you think that made it a different process than somebody who's writing for a CBS or a...
I think so, because we didn't have a pilot when we got started. Mm. So you don't get to see what the show is going to look like. You don't see the world. You kind of have to project that. You don't know what's... I think until something like that has been shot, you don't really know exactly what works and what doesn't. And I think that it's a different game when you've got the pilot and you know what you're building from. And here it was kind of like, well, it's just hope for the best and just, you know, trust that this is going to work. And then when we saw the pilot, I admit I cried through half of it. I was like, this is so cool.
Oh, wow.
were they using directors from like Riverdale or how was that?
Yes, the guy who did the pilot, the first 2 episodes was the same one who did. Did he do the pilot for Riverdale? I'm not sure, but he did a bunch of episodes on that.
Okay.
I think a bunch of them were, maybe even all of them had done some Riverdale, but yes.
So how do you get to direct an episode?
Oh, that's the big question, right?
Like, you just have to hang around long enough and,
they're listening.
And does that even happen? Do people make, very often, do people make the shift from being in the writer's room to actually also getting to direct episodes? Or is that
I don't know, but
rare?
That's the dream, isn't it? Yeah. That would be so cool, yeah.
I can't, because I don't think in Dexter that would have happened very often, right? Somebody in the writer's room going into the directing.
No, now that I'm thinking about it, I don't think any of them directed. And some of them have had directing history, like Manny Coto had done Dr. Giggles, which I think qualifies.
Wait, so you don't think Manny directed it?
I don't think he directed one, but usually at some point, depending how successful a show is, they'll let the lead direct because that's their kind of almost their bargaining chip for sticking around for another season. Like, sure, if you let me direct one or whatever. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I'd have to look into it, but I haven't seen many shifts where it's the writers get to direct the TV show, whatever.
It's just to me, that seemed to be the goal originally was like, if I can get into directing TV, that would be amazing. And it's still, I mean, that would be fantastic. But I've learned to, writing used to be a means to an end, and I used to write just because no one else would write the stuff that I would want to make. But I've learned to really love it. And I think this was definitely part of that. But the last couple of years, like, I really learned to appreciate the craft and understand it much better. And like, I met a lovely fellow screenwriter who just kind of made me help understand what screenwriting was like and kind of fall in love with it and enjoy the act of writing, which I don't think, I think even a lot of screenwriters don't do, really.
It's a hellish process.
Yeah, it's always like you like having written more than writing.
I mean, I know this is a broad question, but it was like, what was the most valuable lesson you learned in the process of writing for TV? Like, what do you think of your skills got strengthened? Could it be just letting go of certain ideas and focusing more on what's going to be best overall?
Or? I think I like the way that that characters are leading decisions, definitely. I think that's something that I kind of had originally in features, but definitely kind of saw more here. I like the way that you plan things very meticulously before you start writing, because I used to be the kind of person who'd be like, I have a big idea, and then I'll just go to draft and
that, see if something
and then
comes
you fail
out.
And then and here, you know, scene by scene exactly where you're going, which is perhaps, to me, when I write a feature, is too much information because it kind of slightly ruins the fun. But when you're doing it as a group, or if you have a whole room and we all need to be together, it's really interesting to know before you go to draft what the script is going to be like. And I think that it's a good compromise, because I've definitely learned about structure and about kind of being ready before you start writing.
But you were an outliner in your features before you started, or just looser outlines?
I was starting to be.
Yeah, I was starting to be.
And that's why I was saying, like, the whole three-act structure I've always felt was so much bullshit and just like, no, I want to be loose. And then you realize, no, the three-act structure is not about tying you into something. It's about teaching you to plant a seed that's going to pay off at some point. And it's all those, it's almost like mathematical, and it's really cool and really fun to write.
And somewhat primal. Like, it's not just something that Robert McKee came up with. It's like primal in the way we have always been telling stories. We've just found terms for it, right?
Yeah.
That we're looking for them. That's interesting.
But it's almost doing in structure what Stephen King does so well with scares. I've always loved the fact that he can plant an idea that later on becomes really scary.
Like, yeah.
I
one of my favorite scares of his that have never made their way onto screen is in The Shining, when they start hearing the elevator at night. And they know that there's those sounds of a party going on somewhere in the hotel. And then the next day when they open the elevator and they find the confetti on the ground, and I was like, my God, this is so scary.
That is a good, that's a good, yeah, you're right.
Ton of little elements that come together and that, oh my God, this was
maybe
real.
In Flanagan's Doctor Sleep, there will be a reference to that moment. That'd be good.
Yeah, another, there you go. Calling back to a seed we dropped earlier this episode.
There's a three-act structure to this, maybe.
Well,
I don't
three-act
know.
Structure to
probably
our show.
Not. Maybe a two-act structure. We have no ending. We just suddenly abruptly end things. Every time. No closure.
That's the way I end most of my first drafts.
You know, and all our relationships. But that's all right.
So this show, Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, is on all episodes on Netflix October 26th. Mm-hmm. Have you seen, how much have you seen of it
so far? I've seen the first three.
Okay.
And I co-wrote episode 9. Like, I worked on every one of them, but except the first two. But I haven't seen the episode that I wrote, so I'm very excited to see that. I'm excited to see all of it, to be honest. That specifically is my first TV episode. It's so cool.
That is pretty
my
cool.
My first TV
credit. You got to take a screen grab when your name comes up, written by.
For sure.
And like all Netflix, it all comes out at once, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, I'll be that obnoxious person who'll post that everywhere.
You
got to
do
sure.
it.
Yeah.
You got to promote it. And what about, what about now? I mean, it's probably early to say what's next, but now that you've done TV and got a taste for it, should a second season get greenlit for this? Would you want to continue in TV, either this show or there are other shows that you might be fun to try to take a crack at?
I kind of have the answer to that is that the second season is greenlit.
Oh.
But I'm not writing on it, and I'm trying to focus on a few screenplays that had been – that you kind of – when you do this, you have to be very much absorbed in that world, and you can't develop TV at the same time when you're a writer kind of at not at a super high level if you're not a producer. And it just felt like I would love to work in TV again. I would love to do another writer's room, especially for a show of this amazing quality and like that fits so well with the kind of stuff I like. But I want to do my own
series,
stuff too.
How does that work though? Like if you're on a series that I assume would probably get renewed if it does well, do writers, would you be likely to be invited back? How does that work if the show keeps going?
It always works. Like at the end of the season, you decide if you want to go back, showrunner, decide if they want to renew you. It's kind of, you have a contract that's for a certain amount of years, but it's always with the option of being picked up or for you to leave. It's very involved. It's like, I worked on this for almost 7 months. And if you keep going, you go straight away into another 6 or 7 months, and it's a lot of time.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You know, as a filmmaker, it's kind of cool to also get to do your own stuff. So I feel like it's a good compromise to get to do a little bit of writer's work and a little bit of my own. I wish I could direct something soon. That would be really cool.
Yeah. Riverdale, maybe. Have you seen Riverdale yet?
I have, yes.
Okay.
Well, I haven't seen season 3 yet, but yeah.
Oh my God, they're
on season 3. Oh, I'm so behind. Good God.
I think I almost finished the first season.
I finished like 23 episodes. It's insane.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, because it's normal TV.
It's the CW style.
Yeah. I just remember Skeet Ulrich coming in and going, "What?"
It's like he's great in it.
Yeah, no, he's good.
Yeah, a lot of good characters.
When it didn't go full horror, I was like, okay.
But I think season 2 goes full horror, but I don't know.
Really?
Somebody's probably screaming at us in their car right now, like, "You have to watch season 2 and 3."
You guys. Actually, I think I first discovered Riverdale because you guys talked about it on Shockwaves.
Actually, probably is because I do remember that early on.
In a slightly indirect way, I ended up on Sabrina because of Shockwaves.
Wow.
Well, I wouldn't call it indirect. I'd say exactly
the record. It's thanks to Elric and Rob, for sure.
So because of my crush on Veronica, you are writing Sabrina.
Yes, that's exactly.
I had my debate about it.
Because I watched Riverdale. I loved it. I told my manager. She submitted my stuff to the company. And then they liked it, and they were like, when Sabrina showed up, they were like, oh, there was that script.
If you'd listened to the wrong podcast where they were like dissing that, you would never have watched it. This would have been a chain reaction. Oh,
that's
wow.
right. Look at that. We're changing lives here at Shockwaves.
There you go.
And I'm seeing residuals. I'm thinking we get just a little taste.
Well, something, a little pat on the back. I don't know.
Something. Maybe a DVD.
That's really funny.
Maybe one good horror recommendation from this book we'll get.
I'll
take that. That's how low on my bars now.
Well, we already talked about ghost movies that are in this book, but you know, we ask everybody that comes in here, like, what's contemporary horror that's exciting? I mean, you go to the festivals, you go to our movie nights when we can organize everybody together. Who are the filmmakers or films of the last couple of years that have stood out? Like, I really love that.
Tough.
I know, but you know,
because there's so much stuff that we watch, it's so hard. Can I come back to that?
Sure. I mean, this is your chance to give love to Hereditary or Hate to, or whatever.
I love Hereditary. I think for sure. I love Ghost Stories.
We're at Mike's. Awesome. Yeah,
it was Mike's birthday. Everybody went to see
that. Was the one where we sung at the end.
Well, because it was fascinating to see. Everyone was being affected, whether they liked the movie or not. Like, it was an amazing screening because you could just feel filmmakers being affected by the filmmaking and quietened by it. But
I hated it watching it.
Yeah,
I hated the experience of watching it. And they came out being like, "I hated this. This was terrible. Not terrible, like, not well made, because it's beautifully made. That's undeniable. But just coming out, just thinking, I did not enjoy any part of this experience. And then for the next few days, I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I thought, if something affects me that much, I can't wait to watch it again.
That's right. It's only just now that you said that I remember you weren't high on it when you first came out, and that makes sense. But you're right. I wish more people could be open to art
because
you're allowed
thing.
To be mad and you're allowed to be like, I had those reactions to a lot of Cronenberg's work when I was young. So I especially Dead Ringers and Crash, seeing it in theater when I was like 19, I almost wanted to walk out halfway through. There's certain scenes and then it's just something to my body, like, don't like this. And then later on, I watch it and go, oh yeah, this is really interesting. So I don't even know what it is with his movies that made me, but Hereditary, it's pretty clear what they're pushing the buttons, and he's manipulating in that classic way. Like, he's really pushing you around and doing whatever he wants to
and
us.
And it's the characters' reactions to the things that happen, and it's almost worse than the actions themselves. Like, the big thing that happens was less terrifying to me than the fact that the kid can't cope with it.
Yeah.
And that's what would keep me up at night. I'd be like, oh my God, something that you can't cope with. This is just terrifying.
Yeah.
It's those human reactions that really affected me.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that. But that was a great screening. And it was interesting because some people did come out really like, I hate it. And other people's like, that was the best thing I've seen. It's like, wow, okay, that was pretty, yeah, it's interesting to see that. I wish all films had that energy when you walked out. The last time I had felt that was coming out of It Follows with Dave Parker and Beck in that, where Dave Parker was like, I didn't like this, and Beck was kind of on his side, and I was like, that was the best thing I've seen in years. How are you guys creating? And it was before anyone had seen it. I remember, it, I was like, how did you not see the same thing? But I bet they've changed too, because this just happens, you know?
I think they both still hate it.
Oh, really? Okay.
Well, but I don't know. I like it. I'm on your side. I'm team It Follows.
But no, but it is interesting how art or any kind of film does that. It's, and when you're not getting either sides, it's when you're not making anything really interesting, right? It's like when you're that middle of the road, like, yeah, it's all right.
Yeah, because then you don't remember it.
You're who cares?
It was what it was.
No, it's definitely that one ghost story was really good. We were talking about this movie earlier, but from Fright Fest, I did really like The Ranger. Yeah. Not like the movie itself is really cool, but to me, it was more the fact that someone who had this tiny budget managed to make something so stylish, and I'm super excited to see what else she's going to do.
What's what I liked about The Ranger was the humor of the killer, you know, having a character who's like built up as like the killer type character, but then they're really funny in a not a cheesy way. Like, I don't know, it's actually genuinely humorous.
And it wasn't scared of having lead characters who were genuinely unlikable. Some of them were just, you just wanted them to die, but everyone, not in the slasher way, in the way that they're very realistic. And when they die, you're actually still affected because they feel like kind of real in a way, but but you don't necessarily like them. And I think that's always super brave when you have a movie that doesn't try to make you desperately like the characters that you're supposed to follow.
Oh, yeah. No, there's nothing more contrived, you know, than that. But I'm trying to think. Oh, here's one last question that I need to know, because I love to ask you I love to annoy you about things like that. So Belgium. That's my favorite thing to go to with anyone from so. But is there any, because I can't think of any, and we've talked about horror films from Belgium, but are there any ghost stories from Belgium that you came across?
In film?
Yeah,
or
I'm just curious.
Books?
Or either. I mean, like, if not in film.
Because in books, there's an author called Jean Hay, who, I don't know when probably 40s or 50s or something like that. But he wrote tons of ghost stories that I found when I was maybe 7 or 8. I found my dad's books that he'd hidden in the attic. And because I wasn't allowed to watch anything scary, but I was already fascinated. Like, anything that was ghosts or skeletons was fascinating. And I found those books, and they were, I think the books were basically just a collection of ghost stories. And they scared me so much, but in a way that made me love this kind of stuff. And
do you remember if they're any different than other people's ghosts? Or like, just, I'm always curious if there's any flavor of a nationality that comes through, or not really, or too hard to remember.
I don't remember from those, but I know generally Belgium's very good at being surreal and being kind of, you know, strange.
René Magritte.
Yes,
you've got the surreal down.
But even something like Calvaire really plays on that.
Oh, yeah. No, Calvaire is a fun movie.
I
it's
love
like
it.
A super interesting.
Yeah, it's really cool.
But yeah, because there's some, there's some Belgian films, but I mean, everyone just knows Dardenne's and
But there's, I think Calvaire is the one I would definitely recommend. Cub. The Jonas Gavart movie.
Yeah.
I think he was on, was he on Killer POV or on
Shockwaves? I don't think so.
I don't think he was on, but that is an intense movie.
Cub,
It's been a while
That's
now since
cool.
I've seen it, but I remember it.
And then there's one from the 70s, Daughters of Darkness.
Harry Crimmel. I think that's just,
I was
going to
say,
gorgeous.
That's an Elric movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful fucking movie. But
I went to see one of the locations last time I went back to Belgium. I drove through Ostend and I went to see what the hotel looks like.
Oh,
on
so
the
that
outside.
Hotel is the real thing there
now
still?
The outside is in Ostend and the inside is in Brussels.
Well, because the actress Delphine Seyrig, who's like famous for like art house French films, Chantal Ackerman's also from Belgium, I think, because there's because French Belgium, so a lot of films, a lot of people have grown up and say the art house stuff, they just think they're French because they're in French language, but they're actually French Belgium and stuff. So
and Belgium has obviously it's French
and German,
German a little bit, but mostly Flemish, which is kind of Dutch. And those identities are so completely separate that I'm sure that there's horror movies in Dutch that I'm more Flemish that I'm not aware of.
So you were which part?
French.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay, so I didn't know that. See, you get a little geography lesson at the end. You can't let her off without that.
Well, I just really quick, I have a hardcover book of this, of the ghost movies in front of me. But is this in paperback as well?
There's also in paperback.
Okay, that's what's confused me, because on Amazon here in the U.S., there's only paperback versions of these available.
I guess they don't want to ship stuff that's so heavy.
Okay, well.
That does make sense. I mean,
and I'm
books
pretty
are...
sure we'll have a Singing at Dark Delicacies, by the way.
Oh, there you go. So we'll keep you – well, you can also order from darkdel.com when you do the signings. We'll keep you posted, but for right now, if you want the paperback of Fright Fest Guide to Ghost Movies, this is on Amazon. and it's like $20. And the Chilling Adventures of Sabrina is on Netflix October 26th. Very proud of you, Axel. Can't wait
to see it. Oh, and Tales of Halloween is still on Netflix this year, so check it out.
For now, but you can get a wonderful Blu-ray DVD combo on the epic-pictures.website because I freaking made that thing.
You guys
do
not want to miss seeing my shoulder.
Your shoulder?
In this movie.
Becca's got...
Where's your shoulder?
Standing next to Becca.
Becca's, yeah.
Everyone always goes to find me because I was dressed as Santa, but I don't think I ever...
Oh, that's right.
I dressed as Killer Santa, but I think only my arm ever made it into any shot.
I think we're all in...
Oh, we're in some background
segment.
Thing. Yeah.
Andrew Cash's segment for like a second, but Becca's the most prominent.
And if you still frame it, you can only see my arm. I
don't
think there is a shot of me.
And Becca's also in a different segment, right?
She brings
She's
Marnie.
She's the one who brings the kid and Trick.
Marnie's trick-or-treating to and Girash's segment, yeah.
And Becca always just steals the limelight of our show. We're just background. It sucks.
I'm in the film like maybe four times. Uh-huh. I think sometimes it's just my hand, but I have my head in the pumpkin.
You know who's most noticeable?
Yeah,
the most noticeable cameo in the history of cinema. When cinema, like, forget Hitchcock. It's your shot of Mick Garrison. I remember sitting in the theater going, that's Mick Garrison. It was like such
a
cameo.
He's like a phantom or something, right?
Yeah,
such a good sport.
With that glorious hair.
He does not like to dress up, and he was not excited.
But I definitely didn't miss that one. But anyway.
Yeah, and Stuart Gordon.
Oh, yeah.
Also, same thing when it's like, you're going to be Sherlock Holmes. He's like, okay, whatever.
I think, and Barbara Crampton's in that scene. I think she's the only one that's not recognizable at all.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And Lisa Marie's in the film, too.
Who is?
She's in that scene. Lisa Marie.
Oh, Lisa Marie. Yeah,
she's
yeah.
Great.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. It's a fun movie. It's Halloween season. You should watch Tales of Halloween on Netflix and then buy the Blu-ray because it won't be on Netflix forever. And then watch Sabrina on Netflix. So there.
Wow.
There you go.
Lot.
Lots
that's
of Netflix.
Plan.
Yeah.
All right.
And watch all of that Flanagan show.
And if you get the book and find recommendations that you like, hit me up on Twitter.
What's your Twitter handle again?
Axel_Carolyn, I think.
Yeah, we think. Okay.
Not the Flemish part. At not the Flemish part. That's her, that's her new handle.
Actually, there's no underscore. I think you're just Axel Carolyn.
Am I? I don't know.
Yes, you are. Anyway, you're gonna be tagged when we post this episode. All right, Axel, thank you so much for coming by.
Fun.
We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Happy Halloween.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Happy Halloween.